Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Princeton University announced today it will remove the name of former President Woodrow Wilson from its public policy school because of his racist views. The move reverses a decision by the Ivy League school in New Jersey 4 years ago to keep the name. Now, Wilson was president of the university before becoming the governor of New Jersey and then president of the United States in 1913. He supported segregation, barred black students from Princeton, and spoke approvingly of the Ku Klux Klan.
You are doing your homework, I hope.
I'm trying. I'm not real good at math problems.
Mathematics is simply a matter of seeing the pattern or sequence and following it to its conclusion. Let me see your problem.
You want to help me?
Why not?
Why would ya?
For one of your jelly beans, I would help you solve half a dozen problems.
Don't take the red ones. They're my favorite.
Now, let me see your book. So you don't care for mathematics?
Mm-mm.
What do you hope to be when you grow big? What do you want to be?
I don't know what I'd be good at.
Well, what would you like to be? You must have a dream.
Not a real one.
Do you like school?
Not anymore.
I didn't care for school either. My teachers were drill sergeants. No sense of the joy of learning.
Joy? I don't see a lot of joy in it. What I've seen, school won't make a difference to me anyway.
Oh, there is great joy in learning, believe it or not, even in mathematics.
I think I got enough math to get by already.
How could anybody be happy simply to get by? Especially if one accepts that mathematics may hold the key to unlocking the mysteries of the universe.
I can't imagine why Dr. Einstein has taken such a shine to our little girl.
I think maybe he sees her as a kindred spirit. Having been oppressed himself, he has empathy for anyone who may have been similarly disadvantaged. A colored child, an old Jewish man. No doubt he sees their similarities more than their differences.
Well, they seem to enjoy each other.
Yes. Apparently they do.
To me, nature itself is a mathematical puzzle with remarkably straightforward and elegant solutions.
Can anyone ever figure out all the secrets of nature?
Where the universe begins and ends? What lies beyond? I believe so. God, they say, he's mysterious, but I do not think he is malicious.
Are you a religious man, sir?
I revere nature. I believe in the possibility of harmony and a brotherhood of mankind.
Then you are.
If you say so.
And now introducing Lanny Lewis.
Parents, teachers, students, and honored guests. The subject of my display is light. Light is a wonder of nature, an inspiration to students of science and God. It is a wonder both ancient and mystical. Traveling across space at over 186,000 miles per second, or 300,000 kilometers per second. It is the measuring stick against which all physics are relative. It is the source of life on this planet. But the thing I like most is its color. People think light has no color, but they're wrong. True, light is usually not blue, or green, or red. But as we add colors, we see. It is only when all the colors of the spectrum are combined together, blended in harmony, that we finally achieve pure, clear, and perfect light.
Context of white supremacy. Robust celebration there. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, July 2nd, 2020, so I have been told. This is our third book study on Fred Jerome, Roger Taylor's Einstein on Race and Racism. Again, Fred Jerome, suspected white man, Roger Taylor, black male, the authors of the book. This is our third installment. We are picking up on chapter 7. Not a very long book, so we're kind of halfway through, maybe even a little more. Not too long, so we won't be on this book too much longer. Wow, what a week, and our timing has been pretty solid with this book selection. Whew. So we spent all that time, whole chapter, thick chapter, in fact, in a short book. So, I mean, that's a significant percentage of this text talks about the years of white supremacy racism at Princeton. Woodrow Wilson, his efforts both as president of the school and then president of the country. They talked about Jigger, Polite Paul, some of the Negroes who were allowed to sell apples out of their wheelbarrow on campus, right? They talked about all that. We had some of our listeners that, man, all this, it seemed like they're just wasting time, you know, padding the book a little bit. You know, they don't need some materials. They stuff a few pages in about the history and foolishness at Princeton. And I said, wow. And I played that segment where Roger Taylor, the black author, he said, hey, the thing that, you know, stood out the most to me in putting this project together was the years of white supremacy, institutional white supremacy at Princeton University. So I said, oh, okay, I have a little bit better understanding. And to kind of help put that in context, Albert Einstein and his work while he was on the campus. Then we get to this week, all the protests about racism and everything. Princeton University decides to take Woodrow Wilson's name down, not just from one of their academic halls, but also from a residential center as well. And this has been going on for years. They had been saying, hey, we need to take his name down and blah, blah, blah. You remember back in 2016, this came up for discussion and they decided not to make any changes at that time. Wowee. Timing is everything, I reckon. Anyway, we will go ahead and get started with our book study. Again, we've made big progress. We'll get more information on Albert Einstein and his relationship to Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, presumably other black people. We also heard a little snippet from the movie segment, Einstein, Light to the Power of Two, this about his relationship with one of the young black girls who lived near the university. Some of the folks last week suspected this sounds a little, you know, Jerry Epstein, you know, messing around with these young girls. I don't know. Heard this before. What's the Jerry Sandusky? I don't know. We'll keep that in mind as we proceed. Context of white supremacy. Again, this is Fred Jerome, white male, Roger Taylor, black male. Their book, Einstein on Race and Racism, audio segment number one.
Chapter 7, The Home Front. Barred from working on the Manhattan Project and denied security clearance by the Army, based on Hoover's memo, Einstein remained in Princeton, wielding a pen as his main weapon to support the war effort. There is no evidence that he knew he had been banned from working on the bomb, but he may well have suspected. After his backstage visit in 1942, Einstein did not meet Robeson again until after the war. In the meantime, both supported several war-related organizations, such as the American-Soviet Friendship Council. Following the momentous Soviet victory at Stalingrad, Einstein wrote a fundraising letter for the council and sent greetings to several of the group's rallies, where Robeson was a frequent speaker. Like the Russian War Relief meeting mentioned earlier, the council attracted an array of prominent and politically moderate supporters. Months after the war's end, one support rally in Madison Square Garden drew thousands of people, and at least one of J. Edgar Hoover's agents, who reported, quote, "Messages of greeting were sent by President Truman, Admiral King, General Eisenhower, Secretary of War Patterson, Eleanor Roosevelt, Professor Albert Einstein, and others." Throughout his FBI dossier, Einstein's name appears in capital letters. Would Einstein have agreed to work on the bomb if he had been asked? At least some signs point to yes. For more than a year during the war, Einstein worked as a consultant for the U.S. Navy, which gave him security clearance even though the Army refused, on problems relating to high explosives. Also, in 1943, he donated a hand-rewritten copy of his 1905 Special Relativity Theory to be auctioned off in a fundraising effort for war bonds. Staying in Princeton during the war meant, too, that Einstein could maintain his habit of walking around town, including his Witherspoon walks, with stops at Miss Pennell's house and others to sit on the porch and chat. Besides the weather, the war, and Robeson's performance in Othello, their chats inevitably included events on the home front, where in several cities around the country, a very different kind of war was simmering. Walter Jackson, a 35-year-old African-American defense worker, his wife and five children, moved into the new federally sponsored Sojourner Truth houses in Detroit in spring of 1942. "We're here now and let the bad luck happen," Jackson said. "I have only got one time to die, and I'd just as soon die here." Jackson, a short, wiry, 130-pound former UAW CIO shop steward, had taken an active part in militant auto sit-down strikes in 1937. The Sojourner Truth Project had been built to ease Detroit's acute housing shortage. Tens of thousands of white and black workers had relocated from the South to work round the clock, producing tanks and planes. The new housing for blacks was originally planned for a black neighborhood, but the federal government switched and built it in the midst of a white working class community. Integrated housing was not permitted by the Federal Public Housing Authority. On February 27, 1942, with a cross burning in a nearby field, 150 angry whites picketed the project, vowing to keep out blacks. By dawn the following day, the crowd had grown to 1,200, many of whom were armed. The first black tenants, rent paid and leases signed, arrived at 9 a.m., but left the area fearing trouble. It wasn't long in coming. Fighting began when two blacks in a car attempted to run through the picket line. Clashes between white and black groups continued into the afternoon when 16 mounted police attempted to break up the fighting. Tear gas and shotgun shells were flying through the air. Officials announced an indefinite postponement of the move. Finally, at the end of April, despite continuing resentment, black families moved into the project. Walter Jackson and his family were the first to move in. Detroit Mayor Edward Jeffries ordered police and state troops to keep the peace during the move. A score of white women, some pushing baby carriages, waved American flags and paraded briefly along Conley Avenue, north of the project. In the following weeks, the Klan burned several crosses, but the United Auto Workers supported the African-American tenants, organizing integrated groups of white and black workers for defense squads and picketing, with much of the leadership coming from the left-wing African-American workers from Ford's River Rouge UAW Local 600. Although the initial Sojourner Truth confrontations resulted in no fatalities, it was a warning of what was to come. According to a Detroit News report, early in June 1943, 25,000 white workers at a Packard plant that produced engines for bombers and PT boats stopped work in protest of the promotion of three blacks. A handful of agitators whipped up animosity against the promotions. During the strike, a voice outside the plant reportedly shouted, I'd rather see Hitler and Hirohito win than work beside a nigger on the assembly line. The Ku Klux Klan and the feared Black Legion were highly visible in the plant. The Packard strike ended only when the federal government threatened to fire the workers for disrupting the war effort. But street fighting broke out in early August at the Belle Isle Amusement Park and escalated into a full-scale riot. When soldiers from a nearby army base joined the white mobs, President Roosevelt sent in federal troops to end the fighting. But not before 35 blacks and 9 whites had been killed and police had arrested 1,800, mostly black, people. When he was asked to join 137 other noted Americans in a statement urging President Roosevelt to use all wisdom to prevent a repetition of the horrors of Detroit elsewhere in our country, Einstein quickly agreed. The statement was more plea than protest. The NAACP and others assailed Detroit's handling of the riot, charging that police targeted blacks while turning their backs on white atrocities. 85% of those arrested were black, and all 17 people killed by police during the riot were black. By contrast, the statement Einstein signed, urging Roosevelt to prevent a repetition of the horrors of Detroit, could not have been milder. Nonetheless, it drew the attention of J. Edgar Hoover's loyalty overseers. HUAC, exhibiting its uniquely analytical ability, quickly concluded that the Detroit race riots were communist-inspired. The FBI made no attempt to investigate the activities of the KKK or the Black Legion in Detroit, or the widespread report that the two racist groups had whipped up the initial violence that became the Detroit riots of 1943. But Hoover's agents did list the Einstein-signed appeal to Roosevelt as derogatory information in the scientist's dossier. For Einstein, signing the Detroit riot statement signaled his determination to use his famous name publicly on the race issue. His future statements would not be so moderate. Like Einstein, Robeson walked on two political legs during the war. While heavily involved in supporting the fight against fascism abroad, he continued to speak out against racism at home. In one little-known action, Robeson and a group of 8 black newspaper men attended the 1943 annual meeting of Major League Baseball team owners and met with baseball commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis to demand baseball's integration. After Robeson addressed the owners for 20 minutes, they applauded, but did nothing. This was 3 years before Jackie Robinson signed with the Brooklyn Dodgers. One evening, in 1942, Einstein's walk through the Witherspoon community took him not to the hospital, but to the Witherspoon School for a meeting of the Princeton NAACP. The school auditorium was crowded. NAACP Secretary Walter White had come from New York, and signs on the wall urged members to buy war bonds. Einstein not only joined the organization, but he later also helped sponsor the NAACP's new legal defense fund. He publicly endorsed the campaign to stop the extradition from New Jersey of Sam Buchanan, who had escaped from a Georgia chain gang after serving 18 years for stealing a pack of cigarettes. The protest movement eventually succeeded in blocking Buchanan's extradition. Fannie Floyd grew up around the Princeton NAACP. My parents were active, especially my father, so I went to a lot of meetings. Princeton had a very strong NAACP organization, and national leaders would come down sometimes. But one meeting left a special impression. In a roundtable discussion with other African-American Princetonians, she recalled, yes, that meeting where Einstein came was held in the Witherspoon School around 1942. I think it was a bond rally, you know, raising money to buy bonds to support the Second World War. I was a teenager, but everyone knew Einstein. We had all seen him on the street, walking on Nassau Street and down Witherspoon. I didn't actually talk to Einstein at that meeting. It was a big meeting. I think Walter White, the national head of the NAACP, was there. I remember somebody came in a limousine. Actually, I kind of think it was Congressman Adam Clayton Powell in that limo. Anyway, there were a lot of folks around Einstein, and I guess at my age, I was in high school, I was probably sitting in the back. Was it unusual for a teenager to attend NAACP meetings? I didn't think it was strange to go to so many NAACP and other meetings. Don't forget, it wasn't so long ago that the KKK was still active in the area. They had burned a cross in Hightstown not too long ago. The discussion turns to more recent racism. They burned a cross in Princeton in the 1980s, Henry Pinnell says, and they're still out there, adds Penny Edwards Carter. Even today, says Shirley Satterfield, that town still has that master-slave complex. It's still there, but it's more subtle. It's not as clear as when we were growing up, but there's still that aura of segregation there. There are still certain neighborhoods, the new rich. Penny Edwards Carter agrees. I've been walking down the street and have women put their pocketbooks on the other side of their shoulder, and I'm thinking to myself, how many people have I hit in the head lately? I think people just see a black face. They don't see the person. We're invisible. And the media plays it up. I think whites who don't really deal with a whole lot of black people think we're a bunch of criminals. Hoover's FBI recorded Einstein's support for the NAACP and the defense of Sam Buchanan as more derogatory information in Einstein's file. Derogatory was not a term the FBI chief tossed about casually. If a report wasn't what he considered derogatory, Hoover wasn't interested. A revealing handwritten notation on an internal FBI memo in Einstein's file declares, "No dissemination, as report contains no pertinent derogatory information." It is difficult to imagine a motive for Hoover's decision to label Einstein's NAACP activity in Princeton and his mild statement on Detroit as derogatory, except for racism. Since his death in 1972, Hoover's public standing has plummeted. At least part of the reason was the exposure of his Dirty Tricks campaign against Martin Luther King Jr. But the FBI chiefs and the FBI's racism began long before King came onto the scene. Hoover learned his racism as the fourth R in the white-only schools he attended, along with white-only churches in the white-only world that was his sector of one of America's most segregated southern cities, Washington, D.C. One of Hoover's first Justice Department security files, set up in 1919, was labeled Negro Activities. It denounced back-to-Africa advocate Marcus Garvey as a notorious Negro agitator and claimed that Garvey's newspaper, Negro World, upheld Soviet Russian rule and engaged in open advocation of Bolshevism. The same files attacked other black-owned newspapers, including A. Philip Randolph's Messenger and The Crisis, edited by W.E.B. Du Bois. Something must be done to the editors of these publications, as they are beyond doubt exciting the Negro elements of this country to riot and to the committing of outrages of all sorts. There is no evidence of any Hoover file on the Ku Klux Klan, which at the time was on a rampage of lynching and cross-burning. The FBI chief tried to avoid civil rights cases whenever he could, according to Hoover biographer Richard Gid Powers, a political moderate. By the 50s, this had become fixed bureau policy. Hoover, influenced by his birth in Washington, identified instinctively with the racial elite of this country. When four young African-American girls were killed in the 1963 terrorist bombing of a Birmingham church, Hoover quashed an FBI probe into the bombing despite strong evidence against Robert Chambliss and fellow Ku Klux Klan members. Inside the FBI, for decades virtually, the only African-American agents were Hoover's chauffeur, Special Agent James Crawford, two other chauffeurs in La Jolla and Miami, Hoover vacationed there, a messenger, Worthington Smith, and Hoover's in-office coat taker, Sam Noisett. When World War II started, Hoover gave all of them the title of FBI agent so they could not be drafted. The Good War ended with the dropping of two American atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the death of some 200,000 Japanese civilians on August 6th and 9th, 1945. If America was united behind the anti-fascist war, the atom bombs that ended the war also exploded that unity. A growing number of critics, many from religious groups, assailed the indiscriminate slaughter of non-combatants as ghastly and morally indefensible. Others, including scientists who had worked on the bomb, worried about how the United States might act as the world's only nuclear power. One group of these Manhattan Project alumni formed the Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists and enlisted Einstein, even though he had been banned from the project itself, as their chairman. Polls showed that while most of Americans supported the bombing, only 47% felt it had reduced chances for another war, and nearly two-thirds felt there was a real danger that atom bombs would someday be dropped on America. On CBS Radio, Edward R. Murrow reported an unprecedented national sense of uncertainty and fear, a realization that survival is not assured. A year after the bombing, John Hersey's Hiroshima quickly became an overnight bestseller. Quote, "Not many people walked in the streets, but a great many sat and lay on the pavement, vomited, waited for death, and died. The bomb killed 95% of the people within half a mile of the center, and many thousands who were farther away." Unquote. The atom bombing of hundreds of thousands of non-white civilians, in addition to the widespread anti-Japanese cartoons and editorials in the U.S. press, and politicians' racially charged remarks, aggravated the racial fault line that had long divided the country. While 98% of the white press supported the nuclear attack on Japan, the black press was more divided, and within a few months of the war's end, increasingly critical. By mid-September, the Chicago Defender had carried articles by poet Langston Hughes, scholar W.E.B. Du Bois, and NAACP Secretary Walter White, all siding more with the Japanese victims than with the U.S. action. An editorial in the NAACP's Crisis said, "The bombing of Hiroshima had raised the question, who is barbarian and who is civilized?" Noting that the 7,000 black workers at the Manhattan Project's research center in Oak Ridge lived in segregated, inferior housing and performed menial jobs only, with no school provided for their children, unlike white workers. The Washington Afro-American asserted the United States had spared the Germans who, after all, represent the white race, and saved our most devastating weapon for the hated yellow men of the Pacific. The paper concluded that Hiroshima had revived feelings in some quarters that maybe the Allies are fighting a racial war after all. By the end of 1945, it was clear that the racial war, if it was one, may have ended in the Pacific, but not on the home front.
Chapter 8. Civil Rights Activist. It was in 1946 that Einstein became what today we might call a civil rights activist, and again linked arms with Paul Robeson. More than 1 million African-American soldiers were coming home. Some would never come home, from the war against fascism, and many black GIs had adopted a double V watchword for victory over Nazism abroad and victory over racism at home. Many of us had illusions that, as a result of the war, the whole system of second-class citizenship and discrimination against blacks would be ended, one black GI later wrote, explaining, "I was in the 92nd Division, along with 10 or 12,000 other black troops. In Europe, the men of the 92nd were regarded as heroes. We liberated a number of Italian towns, including Lucca and Pisa, and when the Italian people saw these brown troops coming into their community, they just hailed us as conquering heroes. So when we came back to the United States, we expected to be treated as if we had made a contribution. We didn't like coming back into a Jim Crow scene." Most of the enlisted men in the 92nd were from the South, and it was ironic for them to return to a country for which they risked their lives, and they still had to go to the back of the bus, could not sit downstairs in a movie theater, and could not leave the plantation except with a pass from the owner. But the defeat of the Aryan super-race in Berlin seemed to have no effect on the Aryan super-racists in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and the like, except to intensify their terrorism. Mississippi Senator Theodore Bilbo, an admitted member of the Ku Klux Klan, called for white men to employ any means to stop blacks from voting. In the first year after the victory over fascism, a wave of anti-black violence, mostly but not only in southern states, killed 56 African Americans. Some were outright lynchings. Others involved police shootings of unarmed victims, with returning veterans the most frequent targets. Einstein's 1946 civil rights activism began with the publication in Pageant magazine of his article, The Negro Question, arguably his most eloquent challenge to racism in America. Writing seriously and warningly, Einstein declared, "There is a somber point in the social outlook of Americans. Their sense of equality and human dignity is mainly limited to men of white skins. Even among these, there are prejudices, of which I, as a Jew, am clearly conscious, but they are not important in comparison with the attitude of the whites toward their fellow citizens of darker complexion, particularly towards Negroes. The more I feel an American, the more the situation pains me. I cannot escape the feeling of complicity in it only by speaking out. Many a sincere person will answer me, 'Our attitude towards Negroes is the result of unfavorable experiences which we have had by living side by side with Negroes in this country. They are not our equals in intelligence, sense of responsibility, reliability.' I am firmly convinced that whoever believes this suffers from a fatal misconception. Your ancestors dragged these black people from their homes by force, and in the white man's quest for wealth and an easy life, they have been ruthlessly suppressed and exploited, degraded into slavery. The modern prejudice against Negroes is the result of the desire to maintain this unworthy condition. I believe that whoever tries to think things through honestly will soon recognize how unworthy and even fatal is the traditional bias against Negroes." Finally, Einstein urged the mostly white pageant readership to get involved in the civil rights struggle. "I do not believe there is a way in which this deeply entrenched evil can be quickly healed, but until this goal is reached, there is no greater satisfaction for a just and well-meaning person than the knowledge that he has devoted his best energies to the service of a good cause." In February, a group of black veterans in Columbia, Tennessee, fired their guns at a white lynch mob attacking their community, Mink Slide, and wounded two of the armed whites. When he heard that armed African Americans had shot at whites, Tennessee's governor immediately sent in 500 state troopers who roped off the community and, firing submachine guns, destroyed virtually every black-owned business in the four-square block area. The troopers arrested more than 100 black men, and police later shot and killed two of the detainees inside jail during what Tennessee officials called a spontaneous outburst. 25 others were indicted for attempted murder. Reading about the case in the New York Times, Einstein could not have missed the headline, "NAACP tells Truman shooting by Tennessee troopers was worthy of Nazis," and the statement of a young NAACP lawyer named Thurgood Marshall, chief defense attorney for the 25. Quote, "The actions of the Tennessee state troopers in roping off the Negro section of Columbia, Tennessee, and firing at will and indiscriminately was closer to German stormtroopers than any recent police action in this country," unquote. That same month, a leading Democratic Party official warned that the revival of the Ku Klux Klan was spreading through Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio, where they were trying to capitalize on the discontent of racial groups of German origin. With his indelible memories of Nazism, Einstein could not have missed the echoes. Shortly after Thurgood Marshall's stormtrooper statement, Einstein publicly joined the National Committee for Justice in Columbia, Tennessee, headed by Eleanor Roosevelt. A few weeks later, he traveled to Lincoln University in Pennsylvania to accept an honorary degree and speak to the students. Einstein almost never spoke at universities during the last 20 years of his life. His increasingly frail health made travel difficult, but mainly he considered the pomp and ceremony of degree presentation to be ostentatious. Some may find it remarkable that Einstein chose to break his no-college rule by going not to an Ivy League producer of prestigious degrees, but to a traditionally black university. Chartered in 1854, Lincoln was the first institution anywhere in the world to provide a higher education in the arts and sciences for male youth of African descent. But for Einstein, the 60-mile trip from Princeton to Lincoln was not a casual choice. His visit was, in a worthwhile cause, he told the assembled students and faculty. The separation of the races, segregation, he declared, is not a disease of colored people, but a disease of white people, adding, I do not intend to be quiet about it. Disease? To appreciate today Einstein's choice of the word requires examining specific symptoms of the segregation sickness so widespread in America 80 years after the Civil War. Black soldiers, as we have noted, when allowed into combat at all, fought in segregated units under white officers. To a true believer, segregation always came first, even before patriotism. Vowing never to fight with a Negro by my side, a 28-year-old West Virginia lawyer and future senator named Robert Byrd wrote to Mississippi's Senator Bilbo in 1945, rather, I should die 1,000 times and see Old Glory trampled in the dirt never to rise again, than to see this beloved land of ours become degraded by race mongrels, a throwback to the blackest specimens of the wild. Byrd has since undergone a change in his views on race. Racial segregation was the rule in most of America in May 1946, with separate and unequal public and private facilities from housing and school to buses and beaches throughout the South and many other parts of the country, including, as we've seen, Princeton, New Jersey. Some textbooks and even some documentary films have pictured the separate and decidedly unequal waiting rooms in southern bus and train stations, and even the separate drinking fountains marked colored and white. But the disease went deeper. Even the blood donated to save lives was donated at racially segregated blood banks, when blacks were allowed to donate at all, with white and colored blood kept in separately labeled storage units. In 1942, in the midst of a world war, the American Red Cross met in Washington and concluded that, while there is no difference in the blood of the races, most men of the white race objected to blood of Negroes injected into their veins. No one apparently asked, according to the writer, how many white soldiers, hemorrhaging from a gaping wound on the battlefield and sinking into a coma, would stop a medic from giving them the wrong color plasma. The policy of racially segregating blood continued in some parts of this country well into the 1960s. The Lincoln students in Einstein's audience, of course, knew most of this in 1946. On Friday, May 3rd, a very simple man came to Lincoln University, one student wrote a few days later in the school newspaper, The Lincolnian. His emaciated face and simplicity made him appear as a biblical character. Quietly, he stood with an expression of questioning wonder upon his face as President Horace Mann Bond conferred a degree. Then this man with the long hair and deep eyes spoke into a microphone of the disease that humanity had. In the deep accents of his native Germany, he said he could not be silent. And then he finished and the room was still. Later, he lectured on the theory of relativity to the Lincoln students. That night, Albert Einstein went back to Princeton. Before returning home, Einstein had dinner at the home of Professor Lawrence Foster and his family. Foster's daughter, Yvonne, recalls, the faculty had been warned that Einstein was very shy and low-key, and in fact, he was quiet and spoke very little at dinner. But he became amused by, her younger brother, Larry's Pennsylvania Dutch accent, and couldn't help but smile during the conversation. She adds, we were honored that during the degree presentation ceremony, Einstein wore Professor Philip Miller's academic robe and Daddy's mortarboard. I was very happy to know that my boy had an excellent opportunity to see Dr. Einstein, one student's mother told Lincoln President Bond shortly after the event. In a letter to Einstein, Bond relayed the mother's words, adding his own thanks. All of us are as grateful as this humble mother. Einstein's choice of Lincoln, as well as his words, clearly seemed intended to send a message to a wider audience. But the media then, like the media now, had different news priorities. While most of Einstein's public speeches and interviews were extensively reported by major newspapers, Even sticking out his tongue at a reporter made the front pages. The mainstream media treated the address by the world's most famous scientist at the nation's oldest black university as a non-event. Only the black press gave Einstein's speech meaningful coverage. The Philadelphia Tribune and Baltimore Afro-American carried first-hand, front-page reports with photos of Einstein receiving the honorary degree from Lincoln's president, Horace Mann Bond, and lecturing on relativity to Lincoln students. The Tribune's headline, stretching across half the page, read, "Einstein awarded portfolio in historic campus ceremony." Other black papers covering the story included the New York Age, New York Amsterdam News, and Pittsburgh Courier. All included photos. No one has yet found a copy or transcript or even notes of Einstein's speech at Lincoln, nor has it ever been quoted in the plethora of Einstein biographies and anthologies. What follows are excerpts from his 10-minute speech based on the report in the Baltimore Afro-American of May 11, 1946. The article, by J.W. Woods, is datelined, Lincoln University, PA. "The only possibility of preventing war is to prevent the possibility of war. International peace can be achieved only if every individual uses all of his power to exert pressure on the United States to see that it takes the leading part in world government. The United Nations has no power to prevent war, but it can try to avoid another war. The UN will be effective only if no one neglects his duty in his private environment. If he does neglect it, he is responsible for the death of our children in a future war. My trip to this institution was in behalf of a worthwhile cause. There is a separation of colored people from white people in the United States. That separation, segregation, is not a disease of colored people. It is a disease of white people. I do not intend to be quiet about it. The situation of mankind today is like that of a little child who has a sharp knife and plays with it. There is no effective defense against the atomic bomb. It can not only destroy a city, but it can destroy the very earth on which that city stood." The New York Times of May 4, 1946, carried a brief item on page 7, with a total of one sentence about the speech. "Dr. Einstein said he believed there was a great future for the Negro and asked the students to work long and hard with lasting patience." Assuming this sentence was taken from the same speech, none of the reports in the black press cite or allude to that sentence or anything similar to it. It is interesting to contrast what the Times singled out to publish with what the black press reported. Einstein's equal rights advocacy was not limited to articles and speeches. At the end of the summer, Paul Robeson asked Einstein to join him as co-chair of a new group, the American Crusade to End Lynching, ACEL, which planned to hold a protest rally on September 23rd, the anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation in Washington. Its purpose would be to demand the passage of a federal anti-lynching law. Einstein agreed. If Einstein had not read about the wave of lynchings that summer, they were rarely mentioned in the major media, he might well have heard about them from conversations with Miss Pinnell and others during his frequent visits to the Witherspoon community. There, as in African-American neighborhoods around the country, news of another unpunished lynching seemed to arrive almost every week, often reported only in the black press. That changed dramatically on July 27th. Millions of Americans were shocked when the New York Times reported a grisly lynching in Monroe, Georgia, on its front page. "Georgia mob of 20 men massacres 2 Negroes, wives, one was ex-GI." It is impossible to feel the impact of the story without reading at least some of it. Monroe, Georgia, July 26th. 2 young Negroes, one a veteran just returned from the war, and their wives were lined up last night near a secluded road and shot dead by an unmasked band of 20 white men. The ghastly details of the multiple lynching were told today by Loy Harrison, a well-to-do white farmer who was taking Negroes to work on his farm and was held at gunpoint when his car was waylaid by the mob. The Negro men were taken out of the car first and led down a side road. The women were held at the automobile. Then a member of the mob said that one of the women had recognized him. Get those damn women, too, the mob leader shouted. Several of the men then dragged the shrieking women from the automobile. The Times account also said that the victims had been shot at least 60 times and the bodies were scarcely recognizable because of the mass of bullet holes. 2 days later, the Times reported. Monroe, Georgia, July 28th. Close relatives of two of the four Negroes killed by a white mob here Thursday failed to appear at funeral services today, and friends voiced the belief that they were too frightened to appear. What had gone unreported and unpunished for months, lynching in America, was suddenly an international issue, and the public attention helped spur plans for the ACEL's Washington demonstration. Some 3,000 anti-lynching protesters turned out on September 23rd. Einstein was too ill to attend, but he gave Robeson a letter for President Harry Truman. "May I wholeheartedly endorse the aims of this delegation, in the conviction that the overwhelming majority of the American people is demanding that every citizen be guaranteed protection against acts of violence. To ensure such protection is one of the most urgent tasks for our generation." When a multiracial ACEL delegation, led by Robeson, met with Truman in the White House after the protest rally, the president told them the time was not right for a federal anti-lynching law. One account of the confrontation that followed reported that Robeson told Truman, "Returning black veterans are determined to get the justice here they have fought for abroad, and their restiveness might produce an emergency situation." The FBI's dossier on Einstein says virtually nothing about his pageant article or his talk at Lincoln. The dossier, in fact, has very little about anything Einstein wrote or said. It reports mainly on his organizational affiliations. But when it came to the American crusade to end lynching, Hoover's informers kept busy. Einstein's dossier had no fewer than 12 pages of items on the ACEL. Including this crusade has all the earmarks of another communist attempt to instill racial agitation. But the nation's chief federal law enforcement officer, J. Edgar Hoover, did nothing about the lynching, just as he ignored the Ku Klux Klan for decades. Despite the KKK's hand in murder, lynching, and assault, the conservative Life magazine reported years later, it was not put under FBI surveillance until 1964. Perhaps it is not completely accurate to say that Hoover did nothing about lynching in 1946. On September 17th, he sent a memo to the Attorney General asserting, "It is a mistake for the Justice Department and the Bureau, FBI, to enter these mob violence cases unless and until there is some showing of a federal violation." The crusade did not end lynching, nor get an anti-lynching law enacted, despite the public efforts of two of America's and the world's most popular figures at the time, as well as support from other prominent citizens, both white and black. But their protests did bring the debate to a wider audience, one more ripple in the current that would swell into a giant wave of people protests in the 1960s civil rights movement. For Einstein and Robeson, the ACEL was their first shared anti-racist organization. There would be more. Einstein's sharpest attack on racism came in a message he sent in September to a conference of the National Urban League. "The worst disease under which the society of our nation suffers," he declared, "is the treatment of the Negro." He added that racism is "the scorn of the principle of the fathers who founded the United States, that all men are created equal." One can hardly believe that a reasonable man can cling so tenaciously to such prejudice, and there is sure to come a time in which school children in their history lessons will laugh about the fact that something like this did once exist. Today, however, this prejudice is still alive and powerful. The fight against it is difficult, as is the fight on every issue which the enemy has thoughtlessness and fatal tradition on its side. First, we must make every effort to ensure that the past injustice, violence, and economic discrimination will be made known to the people. The taboo, the "let's not talk about it," must be broken. It must be pointed out time and again that the exclusion of a large part of the colored population from active civil rights by the common practices is a slap in the face of the Constitution of the nation. We must strive to ensure that minorities be protected against economic and political discrimination, as well as against attack by libelous writings, and against the poisoning of youth in the schools. These endeavors are important, but not as important as the intellectual and moral enlightenment of the people. For example, it is clear that in the South, through economic pressure on the colored population, wages in general are kept down, and that thereby the majority of the people, white and black, suffers pauperization through reduced buying power. If the majority knew of the root of this evil, then the road to its cure would not be long. There is a thing which one could call the moral climate of a society. In one society, there may be a preponderance of distrust, malice, and ruthless egotism. In another, the enjoyment of beauty and of the blooming life, compassion for the suffering of one's fellow men, and rejoicing in their happiness. One thing is certain, no mechanism can give us a good moral climate as long as we have not freed ourselves from the prejudices to whose defeat you are devoting yourself. Before 1946 was over, Einstein signed on with the National Committee to oust Bilbo, joining a bevy of entertainment stars including Gene Kelly, Leonard Bernstein, Fanny Hurst, Oscar Hammerstein II, David O. Selznick, Catherine Dunham, and John Garfield. Other sponsors included Adam Clayton Powell Jr., Elaine Locke, and co-chairmen Quentin Reynolds and Vincent Sheehan. The committee distributed posters, pamphlets, buttons, and 185,000 Oust Bilbo petitions in 32 states. The group also publicized Bilbo's corruption and his role in organizing violent attacks on African Americans attempting to vote in Mississippi. The U.S. Senate has never exactly been a hub of diversity, 3 African American senators, one at a time, since Reconstruction. But in the 20th century, no single senator identified himself with white supremacy as publicly and unashamedly as Mississippi's Senator Theodore Bilbo. Up for re-election in November 1946, Bilbo was interviewed in August on the popular radio program Meet the Press. Host Lauren Spivak asked him about the KKK. Spivak asks, "Do you think you would get any Klan support now, Senator Bilbo?" "I do." Spivak, "You never left the Klan, in effect." Bilbo, "No man can leave the Klan. He takes an oath. Once a Ku Klux, always a Ku Klux." 3 months later, Bilbo was re-elected to his third Senate term. In December, Einstein's FBI file tells us, informants named blacked out furnished the Bureau with literature distributed by the National Committee to Oust Bilbo, sponsored by the Civil Rights Congress. Included in this material was a letter dated December 4th, 1946, signed by Quentin Reynolds and Vincent Sheehan. The names of 55 members of this committee were set out, including that of Albert Einstein. The Oust Bilbo Committee even produced a song it distributed in sheets and on records through its branches in 33 states. Perhaps it was influenced by all the creative talent drawn to the committee, or perhaps by the tradition, still very much alive in 1946, of Woody Guthrie, the working people's troubadour. Called "Listen, Mr. Bilbo," the song had a broad populist appeal, emphasizing America's diversity and Bilbo's anti-everybodyism. "You don't like the Negroes, you don't like the Jews. If there's anyone you don't like, it sure is news." The FBI pursued the committee to oust Bilbo partly because it was anti-racist, a trait Hoover considered dangerous and often subversive, but the Bureau targeted the committee also because it was affiliated with the Civil Rights Congress, a group that publicly defended the Communist Party. The CRC counted Paul Robeson among its leaders, and among its endorsers, Albert Einstein. Chapter 9. From World War to Cold War. America emerged on the winning side of 2 world wars in less than 30 years, having played a key role in both victories, as the only major power that remained relatively unscathed. Japan and Germany had been crushed, Britain badly bombed, and France invaded and occupied. The Soviet Union, bombed, invaded, and partially occupied, lost at least 20 million citizens during World War II. By contrast, the war rejuvenated American capitalism. U.S. gross national product, GNP, jumped from $91 billion in 1939 to $210 billion in 1944. And even more dramatically, in the same years, corporate profits leapt from $6.3 billion to $23.8 billion. With 5.7% of the world's population, the U.S. economy accounted for half the world's manufacturing and more than 40% of its income. It seemed so naturally America's moment, as Peter Jennings and Todd Brewster put it. No problem was too big for American energy and brain power. The world's largest telescope was built in Mount Palomar, California. The first civilian forms of penicillin and other antibiotics seemed to promise a cure for all infectious diseases. Scientists at Bell Laboratory discovered the transistor, and others at the University of Pennsylvania assembled the world's first electronic computer. William Levitt sold his prefabricated houses by the tens of thousands to returning GIs who, with their growing families, populated Levitt towns and dozens of similar tract housing villages in newly created suburbs across the country. Even as Einstein, John Hersey, and a few others appealed to American consciences, how can you remain silent about the arms race and social injustice threatening the world's future? Millions of Americans turned inward, away from the world, focusing instead on settling the suburban frontier. The baby boom and the nuclear family were more immediate and less frightening than the bomb. But not all Americans shared in America's moment, or in Levitt's towns. From the first Levitt town on New York's Long Island, hope-filled families from city apartments resettled into boxy suburban houses with green lawns and white neighbors. Only white. If you were African American, Levitt Town and its imitators were off-limits. In just 6 years, mostly suburban housing starts in America jumped from 114,000 in 1944 to a staggering 1.7 million in 1950. And the mass migration to the suburbs became known as white flight. The biggest gains from World War II were in corporate profits, according to the historian Howard Zinn, but enough went to workers and farmers to make them feel the system was doing well for them. Nonetheless, post-war unemployment continued, especially among African American and women workers, generally the first to be laid off when war production stopped. Black workers were laid off out of seniority and found to be incompetent to work at jobs they had successfully performed throughout the war. Yet, U.S. labor leaders made little attempt to reach out to African American workers, women workers, unemployed veterans, or newly arriving Latino workers, with the exception of a small number of left-wing unions with interracial membership and leadership. Despite the gains unions won through a wave of militant strikes in 1946, U.S. labor leaders failed in their campaign, Operation Dixie, to organize the South, leaving millions of low-wage white and black workers out of the prosperity picture and, perhaps just as important, an escape hatch for American companies seeking lower costs. In the coming years, hundreds of factories and offices would move south for the area's non-union, low-wage workforce, only to move again later to other countries where they could pay even less. And while Southern whites earned little, Southern blacks earned even less. We don't know if Einstein had read about Operation Dixie when, in September 1946, he pointed out in his message to the Urban League, "In the South, through economic pressure on the colored population, wages in general are kept down, and, thereby, the majority of the people, white and black, suffers pauperization through reduced buying power. If the majority knew of the root of this evil, then the road to its cure would not be long." But it is at least an interesting coincidence that Einstein's statement came just as the CIO's Southern organizing campaign was getting underway. Coming at the start of the Great White Flight to safe but, as later experience would demonstrate, largely sterile suburbia, another part of Einstein's message to the Urban League seems prescient. "We have become accustomed to judge everything according to tangible and measurable viewpoints.
food in calories, national and private income in dollars, ownership or non-ownership of a bathtub and of a water closet. Yet there are other things which are just as derisive for the happiness or unhappiness of the human being. A man may own everything that puts him on a high level according to a crudely materialistic point of view, and have a miserable existence. He may be persecuted by fear, hatred, or envy. He may be deaf to merry songs and blind to blooming life. It is similar for social groups, even for whole nations. One thing is certain. No mechanism can give us a good moral climate as long as we have not freed ourselves from the prejudices to whose defeat you are devoting yourself.
Deaf to merry songs and blind to blooming life. It is similar for social groups, even for whole nations. One thing is certain. No mechanism can give us a good moral climate as long as we have not freed ourselves from the prejudices to whose defeat you are devoting yourself.
Hey, Gus, if you're speaking right now, nobody can hear you. All we hear is silence.
Oh, there we go. There we go. Woof, crazy. Crazy, crazy, crazy. Thank you, non-Clemson grad. I'm so thankful that this is one of the few times I didn't really say a whole lot. So really quickly, I'll give out the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number one more time, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Crazy. I thought my audio was there, and it wasn't. But again, glad I didn't really say anything. So we finished our first segment. I gave a guarantee that we will not mess up the chapters as we move forward. Did that 2 weeks in a row. We will have that correct this week. And, yeah, I didn't say a word. I didn't share any notes, give any thoughts. We will get right to the callers. Much obliged to non-Clemson grad for the sound check. Thank you, and hope the audio is working correctly now. Line should be open. Feel free. Get the other folks as well.
Oh, well, I got some stuff. Hi to everyone, and also, Gus, I want to thank you for uploading how to influence, how to win friends and influence people. I think books like that in particular, it reminds you of things you can do to make sure that you're not just being an anti-black zealot yourself. So with that, there were a couple of things that I noted throughout the book. Einstein becoming a supporter of President Roosevelt during the war. You know, one of the things I recently learned was that, you know, Hitler apparently or allegedly, he killed about 10 million people during the Holocaust, right? And, you know, Hitler's remembered as this really, really awful person. I compare that to someone like King Leopold of Belgium, who reportedly killed as many as 15 million people during his time. But I imagine most people don't really bat an eye or probably don't even know about King Leopold. So how is the man who killed 10 million people remembered as being worse than the man who killed 15 million people? Let's see. Paul Robeson became a President Roosevelt supporter and willing to enter World War II and saw it as a fight for equal rights, you know, during World War II. First and foremost, VGQ to Mr. Paul Robeson. But it's interesting that, you know, to compare the fight against the Nazis to the fight for human rights in the United States for black people, I'm not seeing the comparison of how those things are comparable personally. Let's see. Einstein worried that if Hitler got the atomic bomb first, he would hold the world hostage. You know, at this point in history, maybe this is us just being, you know, further along in history and time. But I believe a significant amount of countries at this point all have atomic bombs. I don't believe not one country on the African continent has a bomb. So for all intents and purposes, you know, obviously any country that has an atomic bomb, you know, is basically holding the world hostage. And as far as we know so far, the only country to have ever used an atomic bomb is the United States. And, of course, that was used to kill the non-white people in Japan. Let's see, page 79. They called the Black Legion in Detroit racist, along with the Ku Klux Klan. I think it was the Ku Klux Klan. They were referencing it at that point as well, too. And, you know, it's always very interesting when somehow a black organization or a black person gets labeled as racist. It goes more to the idea that, you know, just like the authors who wrote this book, you start asking people for definitions of the word racist. You know, people start, you know, obfuscating and start saying, you know, silly things like mistreating people because of the color of their skin, not really getting at who's being mistreated and who's the one doing the mistreatment. Let's see, page 85. Let's see, it was ironic to be a war veteran hero, but still be expected to sit in the back of the bus. So returning veterans after the World War II, I imagine that there are many of books that has that specific type of language coming from many of black people from all over the country throughout the history of this country. So whatever general or whatever elected official promising black people that after whatever war, whether it be the Civil War, World War One, World War Two, whatever war it might be, you know, they start promising black people to start get treated equally quote unquote, fairly, justly. And even during World War II, and, for example, and of course during the Civil War as well too, they wouldn't even give black people weapons to even defend themselves against the people who they were allegedly at war at, which is more evidence that such promises were just fleeting and just more intentional. I juxtapose that in particular to Christopher Dorner. Within the last couple of weeks, multiple YouTube channels have uploaded the, what is it called, the Manifesto of Christopher Dorner. And, you know, Christopher Dorner, you know, if people don't know, he was a military veteran, I think an Army or Navy officer, maybe, and then became an L.A. police officer who lost his job. And, of course, you know, eventually it drove him crazy. And, of course, he went on his what I'm going to call, emergency competence, well, that doesn't matter. I think you know what you're talking about, emergency response things from the code book. And I find that completely interesting because in Christopher Dorner's book, he also talked about the idea of America being a great country, but that the only really bad places were, like, for example, some of the people who were the members of the L.A. Police Department, going along with that idea that, you know, America is this great place of beginning the history of this country, but at the same time trying to do something about racism in his immediate vicinity. Let's see, page 86. As a Jew, I said he understands the plight of the Negro in the country and is pained by the situation. Now, I believe, Gus, you're constantly referencing an article that an author said about white people are greatly pained by racism, but not pained enough. So it maybe goes to show that that kind of language is constantly appearing throughout history. And of course, this idea that Jewish people understand the plight that black people, I personally think is one of those obfuscations. As we know, a Jew is not a race, it is a religion. So the idea that something is, you know, not to downplay the Holocaust or anything like that, but one of those things I simply just don't see as comparable. Page 88, segregation comes from patriotism. I personally think they meant to use the word racism. Of course, they were quoting people from the time. And, well, let's see, page 91, the New York Times somehow managed to misquote Einstein when talking about, speaking about Negroes needing to be patient. You know, constantly, you know, we have certain situations that happen throughout history, whether someone is being killed, like currently George Floyd or something like that, or whatever beating, murder, or egregious act of white terrorism that happens, and then black people start doing things like protesting and uprising, and then, white supremacists at all corners of the society start saying things like, you know, you just got to be patient, you just got to keep fighting and start, you know, hitting victims of racism with that kind of stuff. And with that, here's my wife. She's going to say some stuff as well, too.
Yeah. Are you
going? Apparently, she's not going yet, so she's going to hold off. So I'll mute my line.
She does this. That's fine. Misty, non-Clemson grad, much obliged. Thank you all for the commentary. Hopefully, it's worthy of your time and energy. Not related to the book, only because we've been broadcasting for 11 years. Mr. Fuller's concept, Maximum Emergency Compensatory Act, from the code book, was Maximum Emergency Compensatory Justice at one point, but he edited all that. And it's only because we've been on the air for 11 years that we covered all that with Christopher Dorner. It was right after the election. It was right after the Christmas 2012 release of Django Unchained, American cinema classic. But yeah, that Christopher Dorner's killings in early 2013, right after the Super Bowl, no less, do not qualify for MECJ, as Mr. Fuller has written. The first two people that he reportedly killed were not white. One of them was a black male, and the other was a non-white female. And that, boop, automatically disqualifies any
connection to what Mr. Fuller has written. Again, just because we talked about that a lot, many people said the same thing, that that was Mick Jay. We have in the archives, Mr. Fuller came on the air and he read some of the initial reports. In fact, I think he came on the air so early because Mr. Dorner was on the run for a while, like a week, that he was on the air and gave out some of the details about what he thought, but he said, absolutely, it doesn't count. Blah, blah, blah. We talked with Dr. Welsing about it, and yeah, it's all in the archives, 2013, where I guess, yeah, white people might have disrupted. I'll see if I can make sure, but yeah, we went through all that. Anyway, back to the book. Other folks, much obliged again, Miss C, non-Clemson grad. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary on the book, Lord knows we spent many, many hours talking about Christopher Dorner way back when. Other folks who dialed in, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Silent Warrior. This time I didn't go to bed, so it's 3:15 in the morning where I'm at.
Wow.
And starting from Chapter 7, The Home Front, I noticed the Sojourner Truth Project, where the federal government is building housing so that people can come to the war project. Use the name of this black woman, Sojourner Truth. They say that they're going to create a separate space for black people, separate space for white people. But then somebody, apparently somebody wanted to set up a conflict. Probably someone in the office did not like that black people be getting housing and decided to put them in the middle of the white people. That sounds typical of a suspect white supremacist. So that conflict there most likely was engineered. Going on to page 78, I'd rather see Hitler and Hirohito win than work beside a Negro on the assembly line. Immediately, I think about Dr. Welsing, that whites are, in general, uncomfortable in being in close proximity to blacks because it reminds them that they don't have the capacity to produce color, and it also reminds them of the genetic potential of blacks to come to cause white genetic annihilation. And then this actual protest or mob moved by the whites was when three black people got promoted. So that means the white people would subconsciously, who are already, they are subconsciously feeling inadequate, less than the black people that they are now forced to live beside and work beside. But they look at them and think, oh, you still have color. You can still genetically annihilate me. And then you're going to get promoted. So it's almost like the blacks are being twice promoted against them. So just a little commentary from Dr. Welton's, my understanding of Dr. Welton's theory. And it follows up with this name of this white supremacist group called Black Legion. Why are they calling themselves Black Legion when they're targeting blacks? Dr. Welton, I suppose, would say that's because they know that black is where the ultimate power of the universe resides. Okay. As we go on, we talk about Sam Buchanan, his extradition being stopped. And I thought when I read that, finally, one successful campaign that Mr. Einstein has been a part of. Further on, we talk about cross burning on the top of page 81. This woman is saying that they burned a cross in Princeton in the 80s. And then Penny Edwards' character says, and they're still out there, even today, says Shirley Chatterfield. And if they're seeing that in near 2005, we've seen people that are burning crosses. That means right now in 2020, they're probably still there burning crosses in their Princeton or New Jersey. Of course, FBI is not making any attempt to investigate the activities of the KKK. Page 80, something that I noticed Penny Edwards' character says, I've been walking on the street, white women put their pocketbooks on the other side. And then she says, I think people just see a black face. They don't see a person visible. I think people just see a black face. Why does she say people and not, I think white people just see a black face? Probably because white is the default mode for what a person is under the system of white supremacy. There's no evidence of any Hoover file on the Ku Klux Klan, but he's investigating three different Hoover newspapers because they're reporting on racist violence and advocating against it. And in that, when other black people read these reports and also read these editorials and commentaries against it, they themselves develop the ability to start to argue and resist white supremacy. So that's why they're targeted by Hoover, who was passing for white. But meanwhile, the KKK is an organization that is actively killing Americans, black Americans, and they get nothing. They don't get any attention. I thought it was really weak by the authors to not figure out that Hoover was most likely passing and that he had black. Because here in page, because this is 2005 and this information is not about him passing. It's not not like it just came out in 2010 or something. People have known this for some while. Hit me, baby. So it says Hoover, influenced by his birth in Washington, and identified instinctively with the racial elite in the country. Weak, weak. Oh, no, 98% of the white press supported the nuclear attack on Japan. The black press was more divided, and within a few months of the war's end, increasingly critical. I've seen this in this book where the black press are being like, this is not okay, you can't be treating these non-white people, because they're recognizing white supremacy being white supremacy and aggressive actions being committed on other non-white people. But then again, we are the biggest humanitarians, and I think about what Mr. Professor Horn was saying earlier this week, like it's a very good move to connect with other non-white people around the world and have an international perspective and so on, and that kind of destabilizes white supremacy locally, because they don't want to get embarrassed, and they don't want the myth of white superiority to be pierced. They don't want white supremacy to be revealed. So that is kind of good. But at the same time, when we do that, what are we getting when black people identify with other non-white people who possibly have their own anti-black thing going? We're the biggest humanitarians. And what do we get? What do we get for that politically? I think that's worth thinking about. We see a lot of the same thing happening now with the Black and Brown Coalition. I think you made a post about that on Facebook earlier this week. Okay, so there's this point at the end of 85 where it says the defeat of the Aryan super race in Berlin seemed to have no effect on the Aryan super races in Mississippi, except to intensify their terrorism. But for me, I'm thinking, of course, that's not going to have no effect. That's going to intensify them. So it did have an effect. They're saying it didn't seem to have no effect, but it did have an effect. It actually intensified it, and that's what they should have written.
30 seconds.
Of course it makes sense that they would do that, because it makes them fight harder after seeing their brothers in Europe lose. So I think the greatest value of Einstein's moderately weak commentary, I wouldn't say that he's advocating really hard. I think every time I read in this, I'm thinking that Robeson is a much better voice.
Hang on one second, Solid Warrior. I just want to make sure we can get everybody at least once. If you can remember where you were there, and we'll come back.
I remember. Thank you.
Much obliged. Let's see. Other folks who we have missed totally, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, proceed.
Greetings to everyone.
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Yes. So far, my analysis of Albert Einstein is he only comes to the level and this is something I just made up as a white person, that he is basically a non-white person would invite him to some place, and he would go and make a speech, and or if a comment is made about racism, white supremacy, he would second the motion. That is not satisfactory, in my opinion, under the global system of racism, white supremacy. A white person can certainly do a lot more. I do not distinguish time in terms of history. As long as there is a global system of racist white supremacy, whether it was 1700 to 30 minutes ago, a white person can certainly do a lot better as far as if they put their actions where their claims, their verbal claims are, they have the ability and the power to do a lot more. And so far, they have not made that choice, including Mr. Einstein, in my opinion. One thing that I've observed of the book as far as its pattern, there's some similarities, in my opinion, of using the term a person who is attempting to counter the system of race of white supremacy, let's say back in the 40s after the Second World War, in the 50s, as being either a Marxist or a communist, you know, a one word derivative to with the idea in mind to offset any efforts on the part of counter racism. I see something similar today with the idea of someone who is against sexual confusion of using the word homophobic. The two I don't know how to put the two terms into a box by stating one word, but there are similarities as far as the person who would use the term to try to undo whatever of logic or constructive understanding of that the person would have against racism, white supremacy, or sexual confusion, the one word of homophobic and or Marxist or Marxism, that sort of thing. The term Black Legion, it could easily be confusing. I would assume some non-white people would think it would be a organization that either made or is making an attempt to neutralize the system of racist white supremacy, and that is not correct. It is actually organized white supremacist group. There is a movie. There actually is a movie that was done in 1936 starring Humphrey Bogart that speaks about the organization if you wanted to see that sort of thing. I've seen it a couple of times, you know, a long time ago. I watch a lot of old movies, real old movies. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged. Let's see. Other folks that we missed totally. If you have a hand up, commentary to share, proceed. Maybe folks are getting to a spot where they can share.
Let's see. Can I be heard?
Oh, there's Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Yes, Gus. I sleep a lot better at night knowing that Albert Einstein was a devout counter-racist trying to fix the problem of white supremacy. Black blood in the hospital, they had another room for white blood. You know, segregation, that had to cost these white people a lot of money. You know, I mean, just think about it. Like, to go through the problem of all of that, you know. Yeah, good old Albert Einstein. His speeches of supporting the Negroes only appears in the Negro press. When you're in a system of white supremacy, the white people control the media. You know, they're going to make sure their story gets out and only theirs. He's talked about appealing to the moral fibers, something along those lines. And, you know, the white people only knew that, you know, by having a strong black economic base, it would make them much stronger. And it's like, well, they put us in a situation where they know exactly the position we're in. You know, I would give them the benefit of the doubt being a non-American, but then again, this is Albert Einstein. He should know everything. So I think he already knew that, and I just think he was practicing racism. I think the modern-day equivalent to Tim Wise, show up at some place, give a speech, make the black people feel good, and go home. I knew my line. Thank you.
White validation, some might say. Let's see. Much obliged, Thomas in New York. All right. Some of the notes that I took before we get to the second audio segment. On page 76, they're talking about the rally after the war, and they were listing J. Edgar Hoover's agents were present and were taking notes about what Einstein was doing and who else was present. Again, we just talked about this with Dr. Horn. The extraordinary resources that white supremacists devote to keeping surveillance on non-white people, or really anybody, for any reason. It's all throughout Paul Robeson, the biography on Paul Robeson that we've read, and how many conversations and his phone being tapped and people following him all over the world. Same thing right here. The next paragraph, would Einstein have agreed to work on the bomb if he had been asked? At least some signs, evidence, point to yes. We said that before. He still had Navy clearance. I'm glad that they've mentioned that a few times in the text, because they said, well, you know, Hoover was suspicious of him, so that's why he didn't have Army clearance, you know, to work on the project, but he had Navy clearance. You know, he could have just worked on it, and he still had homies. Oppenheimer, I think, retired firefighter, mentioned that last week, who were working on the project. So I'm sure indirectly, directly, he did. Let's see. Next. Going to Thomas in New York's point, they talk on page 77 about him being in Princeton and not working on the bomb. That meant he could continue his lovely walks through the Negro part of town and sit on the porch with the black people. And I just think frequently, because we have been terrorized by individuals classified as white, to have someone who is white or might be white or is closer than we will ever be nice to us and is not calling us nigger and all the rest of it. To have them come and hang out, sit on the porch with us, or do a Tim Wise even better, that can really confuse us and really have us at that point where we are looking for white acceptance, we are looking for white validation with the religion of white supremacy. We have been kind of conditioned to look for that white savior figure. It can really be a confusing experience for non-white people in terms of figuring out what it means to be white. Next, they start talking about some of the protests that happened for white workers during the war. They're upset that black people are being promoted to, like, sanitation or cleaning the toilet during the war. And you got this one fella here who reportedly shouted, I'd rather see Hitler and Hiroshito win than work beside a nigger on the assembly line. The Ku Klux Klan and the feared Black Legion were highly visible in the plant. I thought that was important because you hear so many lines about patriotism and if you don't like it, why don't you leave America and all the rest. It was like, whoa, wait a minute. That sounds darn near treasonous. What are you talking about? Hitler win and all the rest of it, man. That's treasonous. This is wartime. And then the Black Legion, I'm glad that that happened because, yeah, the Black Legion is a white supremacist organization and it would cause confusion. And absolutely, I think Dr. Welsing would have had a field day. With why would a white supremacist organization be called the Black Legion? And also we talked about this specifically in Michigan, like exactly what they're talking about in 2014. And dig this. So we talked about this August 11, 2014 with Dr. Charles Hyde. His book, Arsenal, messed up the title. Arsenal of Democracy, the American Automobile Industry in World War II. See, exactly what we were talking about. And he has lots of examples. It's all about white supremacy, racism, and I mean, like, exactly what they were mentioning. Thousands of white people protesting because, like, five black people got a job in the kitchen making sandwiches for them, and they, like, rioted and protested because of this. Like, and the reasoning, when we had Dr. Charles Hyde on August 11, 2014, that should be significant. That was in the middle of the Ferguson upheaval. I think that was actually like within the first 10 hours of the Ferguson upheaval, but we already had Dr. Hyde scheduled. So we had him on and we did the first 2 hours with him, talked about them rioting over five black people getting hired. And then we switched and we had people in Ferg or in St. Louis at least called in, and we talked about what happened and other, cause that was August 11. Michael Brown Jr. was August 9. Whew, man. Continuing. So next, New Jersey, Sam Buchanan, escaped from Georgia chain gang. I thought they were talking about Ahmaud Arbery. Georgia has never been a good place for black people. James Brown allegedly concluded that. Funniest line in the book so far on page 81. The discussion turns to more recent racism. I just find that. Hilaire, more recent racism. They burned a cross in Princeton in the 1980s. Wow. Let's see. Next. Man, I looked a little sideways at this one. We do have a white co-author for this book at the bottom of 81. Since J. Edgar Hoover's death in 1972, his public standing has plummeted. And I just thought, really? Did they change the name of the building? The FBI building, is it still the Hoover? I think it's still the Hoover building. What do you mean his reputation has plummeted? I don't know. I just had I don't know. They voted about changing the name not too long ago, and it failed easily. Like, it wasn't even close to passing. So what do you mean his reputation? Like, they didn't have a source. There's no footnote. What evidence do you have that it... Continuing, at least part of the reason was the exposure of his Dirty Tricks campaign. Now, they have that in quotes. That, I thought, was an act of racism, white supremacy on the part of the white person. Put the name in the book. I don't think information about COINTELPRO is widespread, and I think that's the same thing. Obfuscating, microaggressions, they'll use terms to minimize. This is government-sanctioned terrorism and murder, not dirty tricks. When you start talking about killing people, Paul Robeson, when you have allegations that this program, they poisoned him, that's why he ends up with brain damage, that's not dirty tricks. This is people dying and going to jail unjustly, and all of this being orchestrated and coordinated by J. Edgar Hoover, whose reputation has not plummeted, in my opinion. Under all of this, they have footnoted, in 1971, the KKK burned a 7-by-4-foot cross at the corner of Route 206 and Princeton Pike as part of a recruitment drive. See, Catherine Watterson, I Hear My People Singing, a soon-to-be-published oral history of Princeton's African-American community. I posted it while we were reading. I tweeted it. The book is out now, obviously. Might be something we could check out for the book club, especially now with everything happening at Princeton. Maybe even see if we could get her on the program. Next, Hoover learned his racism as the fourth R in the white-only schools he attended, along with white-only churches in the white-only world that was his sector of one of America's most segregated southern cities, Washington, D.C., now black chocolate city or latte. White people can move things around, move people around. That's what you can do when you are in charge. Just reminded me of James Loewen's Sundown Towns and how many prominent whites, presidents, vice presidents, J. Edgar Hoover, grew up in these sundown towns. It's amazing. Once you find where they grew up and then just go look at the database, it's pretty consistent. I thought it was important that J. Edgar Hoover no files on the Ku Klux Klan at the time. We did a whole program, incidentally, Millie McGee, who talked about what was mentioned, Silent Warrior, about Hoover having a white parent, non-white parent, and that motivating his racist activity. That's way back in 2009. She has a documentary, What Comes to the Light, I think is the name of it. I have it somewhere. You probably get it online. What Comes, Millie McGee, put her name in. Let's see. The death. Now, Dig, I just mentioned, unless my memory is bad, I think Michael Brown Jr. is 2014, August 9, the death of some 200,000 Japanese civilians on August 6th and 9th, 1945. Let's see. The atom bombing, hundreds of thousands of non-white civilians. I appreciated them saying non-white civilians. That is straight code, not people of color or any other ridiculous language. Make it direct. Individuals classified as not white were bombed. Make it plain. In addition to widespread anti-Japanese cartoons and editorials in the U.S. press and politicians' racially charged remarks aggravated the racial fault line that had long divided the country. Interesting metaphor, fault line. The Washington Afro-American asserted the United States had spared the Germans, who after all represent the white race, and saved our most devastating weapon for the hated yellow men of the Pacific. The paper concluded that Hiroshima had revived feelings in some quarters that maybe the Allies are fighting a racial war. After all, we just had Dr. Gerald Horn on the program Tuesday. One of his many books all about white supremacy racism is called Race War, and that is exactly the premise of the book, that that's what they were doing, fighting a battle of white supremacy racism. You got racists on both sides just squabbling, as Mr. Fuller often says, about how we are going to run this here global plantation. But that is, I think, Dr. Horn's thesis and why only non-white people got a nuclear bomb. And then the footnote, make sure I get this in at the bottom, 2 weeks after he ordered the atom bombs dropped, President Harry S. Truman, in response to critics, declared, when you deal with a beast, you have to treat him as a beast. And this is in the New York Times. Check the date on it. August 10, 1945. Woof. A beast. Not a man. The man not. Not even humans. You are a savage of some sort. And that's what you do. You drop nuclear bombs on savages. Let's see. See if I can get through my final notes. What stood out is big. The Tennessee assault, I think we talked about that in the book about the race wars or white supremacy assaults from 1919. We had the author on the program in 2011. Red Scare. That's the name of it, I think. Red Scare. I'll get the full title in a second, but I think that's one of the incidents mentioned that he talks about over that period, because there were so many. There was one in Chicago and Arkansas, Washington, D.C. I think he even mentions the one where Carter G. Woodson had to run for his life. He almost died. This is before he even had a chance to write Miseducation of the Negro. The period that we're in right now, 2020, when he read the part, Tennessee's governor immediately sent in 500 state troopers who roped off the community and, firing submachine guns, destroyed virtually every black-owned business in the four-square-block area. The troopers arrested more than 100 black men, and police later shot and killed two of the detainees inside the jail during what Tennessee officials called a spontaneous outburst. Wow. Take that, Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. Let's see. Interesting choice as well. We got the Rona and him talking about racism, white supremacy as a disease of white people. Great quote to use. When they give the question at the bottom, now this is the authors, how many white soldiers hemorrhaging from a gaping wound on the battlefield and sinking into a coma would stop a medic from giving them the wrong color plasma? I simply remembered Mr. Fuller's anecdote. He talks about, I believe it's in India, may have been on one of our broadcasts, but I believe it's in India. He talked about there was a ship, it was about to sink. The white people were being rescued, and they saw that non-white people had touched the rope. I don't even think they were black people, but non-white people had touched the rescue rope. They refused to touch the same rope. They stayed on the boat and died. This wasn't one white person. This was a whole lot of white people. That is the value that they place on practicing white supremacy racism. I have to go back and get that to make sure that folks don't think I'm putting a lie on Mr. Fuller. But, man, I think this is in the Cal's archives. Like, I don't even think this is like some little chit-chat or what have you that he, you know, mentioned this anecdote. But that came to mind immediately. Like, No, I think I could probably find several examples where, oh yeah, they put death over practicing racism, or excuse me, they value white supremacy racism more than life. Let's see. Anything else? Oh my God. We just heard Dr. Horn. He talked about Burkina Faso and the push to get a UN investigation on white supremacy and racism, where he has, this is on 91, the United Nations has no power to prevent war, but it can try to avoid another war. The UN will be effective only if no one neglects his duty in private environment. If he does neglect it, he is responsible for the death of our children in a future war. But they have no power to prevent war. They certainly don't seem to have much power to do anything about white supremacy racism, which is the war on the planet. They had a great footnote about the popularity of Paul Robeson in 1947, him being one of the most popular, like literally, he finished in the top like 50 for their official poll of most popular person in the country, and he finished in the top 50. So he was super popular at that time, still talking about racism, white supremacy, and then they went to work even harder on him. Oh my God, this will be my last one. Whew. Man, we are supposed to be reading this book right now. Our timing has just been amazing the whole year. It's been terrible, like absolutely terrible, but I mean, wow. They said on page 95, just do the leave the follow through, right? Basketball metaphor, follow through. Today, however, this prejudice, racism, is still alive and powerful. Isn't it always? People should get tired of using that. Like at some point they say, hey, you just keep using the same cliche. Find something else to say. We heard that one before. No more racism is, you have to figure out something else to say that racism is still a problem. But nobody can use racism is alive and well anymore. That is tired. That is old hat. That is hackneyed. We are getting to the second audio segment. Yep, we're getting to the second audio segment. If you have comments that you did not get to share, write them down. We'll have ample time to share for Silent Warrior and everyone else. Unfortunately, racism is alive and well, as is our book study on Einstein, Race and Racism, Fred Taylor, Black Male, Roger Taylor, excuse me, Black Male, and Fred Jerome, White Male Suspected Racist. So we are still in Chapter 9, the kind of very early portion of Chapter 9, audio segment number 2.
On the international scene, too, there were flies in America's ointment. If U.S. post-war foreign policy were a slogan, it might have been, "We're number one." Indeed, Henry Luce came close to that when the conservative publisher of Time and Life magazines proclaimed the arrival of the American century. But as policy positions go, catchy slogans leave unanswered questions. In this case, for example, how should the planet's single superpower, economically, technologically, and with a nuclear exclamation point, militarily, relate to the rest of the world? How does the biggest kid on the block treat smaller, weaker kids? Einstein and Niels Bohr, the renowned Danish physicist, were among those who urged a policy of cooperation and sharing of nuclear information with the Russians. It would not take long anyways, they pointed out, before Soviets developed their own bomb. Even before the war ended, Bohr, who was at Los Alamos in 1944, after he and his son had made a dramatic escape in a small boat from Nazi-occupied Denmark, met with Prime Minister Churchill and President Roosevelt, trying, but failing, to convince the British and American leaders to invite the Soviets to join in planning for cooperative post-war control of nuclear energy. Churchill and Roosevelt reacted to Bohr's peace plan with alarm and suspicion. They warned the Danish physicist that his proposal threatened U.S. and British security, and they ordered him monitored to make sure he is responsible for no leakage of information, especially to the Russians. Churchill went further, claiming that Bohr's was very near the edge of mortal crimes. The British Prime Minister and the American President, it seems, had already identified their next enemy. Einstein's efforts to move Washington toward international cooperation got no further than Bohr's. In 1947, Einstein wrote to Secretary of State George C. Marshall seeking a meeting.
Einstein hoped to convince Marshall that only a world government with military power could prevent a catastrophic nuclear war. Marshall assigned Einstein's letter to Louis Strauss, then a member of the New Atomic Energy Commission and the man who later led to the effort to discredit J. Robert Oppenheimer. Strauss sent his aide, investment banker William T. Golden, to interview Einstein in Princeton. The scientist criticized increasing U.S. militarism and warned Golden that if Washington tried to impose a Pax Americana, history shows this to be impossible and a certain precursor of war and grief. But the 37-year-old investment banker dismissed Einstein's views as naive in the field of international politics and mass human relations. If Washington would not be moved, neither would Moscow. Four leading Soviet scientists publicly denounced Einstein's support for world government, charging, among other things, such ideas represent the imperialist aims of capitalist monopolists. But Einstein's worries about America's foreign affairs went beyond nuclear weapons. Only 4 months after the war's end, he told a Nobel anniversary dinner in New York, the peoples of the world were promised freedom from fear, but fear among nations has increased enormously since the end of the war. The world was promised freedom from want, but vast areas of the world face starvation, while elsewhere people live in abundance. The nations of the world were promised liberty and justice, but even now we are witnessing the sad spectacle of armies firing on peoples who demand political independence and social equality. Those words could have been a manifesto for the many national liberation movements in former colonies, movements that had gained strength and popular support during their wartime anti-fascist resistance. In Asia, the world's most peopled continent, revolutionary struggles were ablaze. In Indochina against the French, in Indonesia against the Dutch, in Malaysia against the British, and in the Philippines, where armed rebellion broke out against U.S. troops. And communist guerrillas in China, supported by millions of peasants, were challenging the Western-backed dictatorship of Chiang Kai-shek. In Africa, too, discontent was on the rise, with militant strikes by workers in French West Africa, Kenya, and South Africa, where 100,000 gold miners stopped work until they were forced back by the army. Leaving no doubt about his support for national liberation movements, Einstein sent a letter to the Council of African Affairs. Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois were chairman and vice chairman, respectively, declaring, "No reliable or lasting peace will be possible without the political and economic emancipation of the now subdued and exploited African and colonial peoples." That emancipation, he added, is one of the most urgent needs of our time. Once again, this statement might well have been lost were it not, ironically, for J. Edgar Hoover, who recorded it in Einstein's dossier as more evidence of the scientist's dangerous character. America's post-war GNP may have passed $200 billion, but in the rice paddies and rubber plantations of Asia, brown-skinned people, often barefoot, carrying guns, were unimpressed. The national liberation movements, almost all battling Western colonizers, leaned more toward socialism than capitalism. While the United States often sided with the former colonial powers trying to suppress these rebellions, the Soviets, whatever Moscow's mixed motives may have been, wasted little time in providing the guerrilla armies with political and often material support. The Soviet Union was also making an astounding comeback from the destruction of World War II, rebuilding its industry, regaining military strength. It was clearly emerging as the primary challenger to America's first-place position in world power politics. How to deal with Moscow became Washington's primary post-war preoccupation. Most American policymakers, Democrats and Republicans alike, found it easier to blame the growing national liberation movements on the Russians than on British, French, or Dutch, or U.S. colonialism. Revolutionary movements in Europe and Asia were described to the American public as examples of Soviet expansionism, thus recalling the indignation against Hitler's aggression. Since World War I had been such a financial bonanza for American capitalism, Charles E. Wilson, president of General Motors, known for speaking bluntly, proposed an ongoing partnership between business and the military for a permanent war economy, with Moscow as the chief enemy. An iron curtail has descended across Europe, Prime Minister Churchill, with President Truman at his side, told an audience in Fulton, Missouri on March 5, 1946, just 6 months after the war's end. A month earlier, Stalin had given his two-camp speech in which he argued that Western designs against the Soviet Union made peaceful coexistence virtually impossible. In Churchill's Iron Curtain speech, which signaled the West's new Cold War course, the British Prime Minister went on to claim that no less than God himself had divined that America be the one nation to carry the responsibility of the atomic bomb. But not everyone jumped on the Cold War wagon. Questioning the abrupt relabeling of the Soviets from wartime ally despite their heavy losses, the Red Army had defeated Hitler's troops at Stalingrad and then battered the German armies back to Berlin, to Red Menace, and worried about the sudden shift from a hard-won peace to a new war footing, some, like Einstein, warned that the Cold War road would lead to annihilation. And when the word leaked out that the State Department, the FBI, and other federal agencies were bringing former Nazis into the United States to help in the war on communism, Einstein was among the protesters. From 1946 through 1948, American opponents of the Cold War gathered around Henry Wallace, vice president during most of World War II under Roosevelt, and then Secretary of Commerce under Truman, until Truman dismissed him for being soft on the Russians. After he was fired in September 1946, Wallace received thousands of letters and telegrams from Americans, well-known and unknown, who were worried about the trend toward militarism and angry about the federal inaction against lynching. Some wrote because they simply admired a man who stood by his principles. One of the earliest messages came from Einstein. Quote, "Your courageous intervention deserves the gratitude of all of us who observe the present attitude of our government with grave concern." Unquote. A year later, Einstein invited Robeson to his home in Princeton. No cramped backstage quarters this time, and no discussion except perhaps reminiscing of his stage performances. This time, in October 1947, their agenda was politics. Einstein had also invited Wallace, who was about to announce his candidacy for president on the Progressive Party ticket, a campaign both Einstein and Robeson supported, and another Wallace supporter, radio broadcaster Frank Kingdon. With so many of Hoover's targets in one place, did the G-men bump into each other as they stood on the sidewalk or sat in their cars trying to be inconspicuous outside Einstein's house on Mercer Street? The UPI photograph of that group is the only published photograph of Einstein and Robeson together. According to Einstein's FBI file, the Chicago Star, dated October 4, 1947, page 2, contained a photograph of Einstein together with Henry A. Wallace, Dr. Frank Kingdon of the Progressive Citizens of America, and Paul Robeson. An accompanying article stated that Einstein had invited Wallace to his New Jersey home and expressed his great admiration for Wallace's courage and devotion to the fight for world peace. Besides support from Einstein and Robeson, the Wallace campaign received backing from an army of celebrities, including Helen Keller, Thomas Mann, Congressman Claude Pepper, columnist Max Lerner, and Anita McCormick Blaine, heiress to the International Harvester fortune, who sent the campaign a check for $10,000. At a conference co-sponsored by the CIO and NAACP, the National Farmers Union, and other liberal organizations, the delegates cabled Wallace that he had the support of millions and millions who believe in the program of Franklin Roosevelt. Most, if not all, of these groups agreed that Moscow was America's main rival in the world, but they favored talking over shooting, negotiations over war. Coexistence or no existence was one of Wallace's main campaign slogans. Despite accusations from the right, Wallace was not a communist, although the Communist Party backed his campaign. He was neither a world government advocate like Einstein, nor a pro-Soviet like Robeson, but he believed it was critical to work out peaceful cooperation with the Soviets instead of a Cold War, a position Einstein and Robeson shared. But it was in the area of civil rights that the Progressive Party made its biggest impact. Besides challenging Truman to end lynching and establish equal employment practices in federal government agencies, Progressive Party candidates refused to speak in any auditorium or meeting hall with segregated seating. This meant that in most southern cities, they met only in black communities. At the 1948 Democratic Convention, the conservative Southern Democrats split off from the party to form the Dixiecrat Party, supporting Strom Thurmond's run for president. By September, Truman had adopted a liberal persona for his campaign. He also adopted, or co-opted, a number of the planks from the Progressive Party platform, most notably ending segregation in the armed forces shortly before Election Day. More than 1 million Americans voted for Wallace in 1948, the first substantial third-party showing from the left in 24 years, and the last in the 20th century. Yet the number was far lower than Progressive Party leaders had hoped for. Red-baiting had taken its toll, as well as Truman's dexterity at co-opting Wallace's more liberal platform. Wallace's showing in 1948 was the high point. Within a few years, both the candidate and the party became early casualties of the Red Scare, the anti-communist crusade that became known as McCarthyism. This was another side of the Cold War coin. If you don't support this war, you're an enemy of America. If you're not against the Russians, you're a red, or at least a pinko, or a comm simp. Truman later complained about the great wave of hysteria sweeping the nation, but Miller and Nowak, among others, pointed out that he was in large measure responsible for creating that very hysteria. On March 22, 1947, Truman issued Executive Order 9835, requiring every federal employee to undergo political screening and assigning the Department of Justice to make a list of subversive organizations. Suddenly, millions of employees had to be screened for loyalty to the United States. With some qualms, Truman agreed to give total screening authority to J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. It would be 3 more years before Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy and his anti-communist antics appeared on the national scene, but McCarthyism began without him. Under Truman's loyalty program, Hoover's FBI investigated some 6.6 million people in less than 6 years and came up with 0 cases of espionage. However, when its achievement is measured not by the number of spies uncovered, but by the aura of fear created, then the Truman-Hoover loyalty program was successful indeed. More than 1 million employees a year were investigated about what they believe, what groups they belong to, who their friends are, and what they read. Add to that the fear created by the jailing and firing of communists and their defenders, the Taft-Hartley Act making it a crime for union officers to be communists, loyalty oaths required for many, if not most, jobs, from carpenter to college teacher, and congressional committees threatening witnesses with jail if they refused to cooperate by naming names of friends and associates who might be leftists. There is no doubt that part of the goal of the anti-communist crusade was to drive communists and their sympathizers out of the positions they held in unions, schools, and a variety of other jobs, a goal the crusaders achieved. But the suspicion is unavoidable that part of their goal was the creation of fear itself. If a frightened population is an easy-to-control population, it may explain why both sides in the Cold War discouraged dissent and crushed questioning. At the end of World War II, the United States emerged stronger than ever, and Franklin Roosevelt's statement, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself," had never seemed truer. Yet, within 5 years, American schoolchildren were ducking under their wooden desks for protection against possible atomic bombs. Otherwise, intelligent citizens were spending thousands of dollars to excavate their own backyards and install concrete-lined ditches called bomb shelters. And citizens were calling the FBI to report that their neighbors harbored communist sympathies. Those who refused to cower were attacked, and above all, isolated. If you are Albert Einstein and feel free to criticize U.S. militarism around the world and thought control at home, this means that Hoover's FBI, with help from several other federal agencies,
will launch a top-secret 5-year campaign to discredit you, attempt to link you to Russian spies, and initiate a plan to deport you as an undesirable alien. What might be called Hoover's Get Einstein Project was launched on February 13, 1950, the morning after Einstein appeared on Eleanor Roosevelt's first nationwide television program, and warned against the concentration of tremendous financial power in the hands of the military in America, as well as close supervision of the loyalty of the citizens and intimidation of people of independent political thinking. If you are Paul Robeson, this means even sharper attacks against you, as we shall see. But to those running America's Red Scare, far more important than merely attacking the resistors, which often produced only more defiance, was isolating them. With this in mind, Hoover, McCarthy, HUAC, and their cohorts made it clear to organizations like the ACLU and NAACP that it would be easy for other groups and their officers to avoid attacks, subpoenas, arrests, and red-baiting exposés in the media. All they had to do was the patriotic thing, defend their nation and disassociate themselves from the Reds. To isolate radicals, intimidate liberals. That was the game plan. And with the ACLU and NAACP, at least, the Hoover team won in a walk. During a 7-year period, ACLU officials and staff secretly fed the FBI internal reports, memoranda, files, minutes, and other materials and documents. They gave the Bureau reports on the politics and private lives of individuals, as well as information on ACLU activities and internal discussions. Morris Ernst, ACLU general counsel and a committed anti-communist, maintained a special relationship with Hoover for many years, sending him a series of private memos that began, "My dear Edgar, for your eyes alone." Ernst boasted of their friendship in a Reader's Digest article with a surprisingly revealing title, "Why I No Longer Fear the FBI." Not surprisingly, though, through most of the McCarthy period, the ACLU refused to represent communists. There is no evidence that anything like the ACLU's bedding down with Hoover's bureau occurred in the NAACP, but the historian Gerald Horn reports that during the 1950s Red Scare, NAACP officials did not hesitate to touch base with the FBI. Several historians have noted the link between McCarthyism and racism. Even as the Red Scare was warming up in 1948, the NAACP complained of the increasing tendency on the part of government agencies to associate activity on interracial matters with disloyalty. The case of dismissed Labor Department employee Dorothy Bailey provides a telling example. In her hearing before the Loyalty Review Board, one board member asked Bailey, an African-American, "Did you ever write a letter to the Red Cross to protest the segregation of blood?" Unfortunately, the NAACP's response to red baiting was, for the most part, to adapt. In 1948, a majority of the NAACP board voted to expel W.E.B. Du Bois from the organization, despite widespread protests from members and chapters around the country. The board took action primarily because of Du Bois's support of the Wallace campaign, but clearly, too, because he refused to separate himself from Robeson and others on the left. The leadership cracked down on the independence of local branches, and fear of communism and/or of coming under government attack was so pervasive in the NAACP that the organization kept away from even slightly red-colored causes. President Walter White knew that the organization was inherently vulnerable to red-baiting. Although it wasn't part of the leadership's plan, the purges weakened the organization. The NAACP became more moderate, more middle-class, and smaller. The Detroit membership dropped from 25,000 during the war to 5,162 in 1952. As early as 1946, the NAACP refused to join the American Crusade to End Lynching because Robeson was co-chairman and its board criticized Du Bois for supporting it. During the 1950s, they remained silent when the State Department refused passports to Robeson and Du Bois. Furthermore, in the many cases where African Americans faced death sentences after trials that were dubious at best, cases the black press often labeled legal lynching, the NAACP would not get involved, no matter how unjust the conviction, if the Communist-led Civil Rights Congress, CRC, was in any way connected. Led by William L. Patterson, an African-American communist, the militant CRC combined legal advocacy and mass actions. It is perhaps best known for its detailed account of lynching in America, We Charge Genocide, that Patterson, Robeson, and other CRC leaders presented to the United Nations on December 18, 1951. The document charged the U.S. government with genocide against the African-American population, citing thousands of lynchings and shootings by police, as well as arrests, trials, and executions of black Americans on trumped-up charges. The United Nations had refused to sign the UN's Anti-Genocide Charter, and U.S. influence at the United Nations ensured that the CRC petition was never considered. Besides the NAACP's aversion to red-tainted causes, the two groups approached these cases from two different points of view, explained Robert Harris in The Nation. The NAACP felt that the state and federal laws and legal procedures were basically just. Therefore, it relied on legal appeals on the hope that somewhere along the line, the miscarriage of justice would be rectified. The CRC felt that the fundamental basis of the courts and the laws was to preserve an unjust system of Negro oppression, a system with which the federal courts would not interfere. Thus, its approach was political, to bring the maximum public pressure to bear. As with the Organization of Interracial Labor Unions, the Communist Party openly played a leadership role in such mass protest defense campaigns, going back to the Scottsboro case in the 1930s. The clash with the NAACP notwithstanding, the party's fight for the concrete economic needs of the unemployed and working poor, its role in organizing sharecroppers in Alabama, and its vigorous courtroom battles in behalf of African Americans, attracted a considerable section of America's black working class and intelligentsia. A number of these courtroom battles, mostly but not only in southern states, attracted media coverage during the years following World War II, especially in the black and left-wing press. Each case is different, a separate drama, usually a tragedy, with its own cast of heroes and villains, but in one respect, all the cases are the same. Those charged with rape or murder are African Americans. Their accusers are white. The CRC's most famous case was the defense of a 36-year-old black truck driver in Laurel, Mississippi, named Willie McGee, arrested in 1945 and charged with raping a white woman. "They say my husband raped Willamette Hawkins," Rosalie McGee told the Harlem newspaper Freedom. "But I say if anybody was raped, which there wasn't, it was Willamette Hawkins raped Willie, not the other way around." In a scenario recalling the false rape accusation that is at the center of To Kill a Mockingbird, Willamette Hawkins wouldn't leave Willie alone. She followed him around on the job where he worked. A white woman in the South, if she wants a Negro man for herself, she don't care if he has a wife and children or not. If he does what she wants, she can holler rape. If he doesn't, she can still holler rape. If somebody else don't like what's going on, they can holler rape. No way can the Negro man win. To begin to comprehend what Willie McGee, his friends, family, and CRC attorneys went through, it is necessary to imagine To Kill a Mockingbird without the fair-minded, kindly judge, the balanced courtroom atmosphere, and the black spectators free from intimidation and violence. Instead, picture a courtroom with a judge, a jury, and spectators expecting a hanging, with armed men charging forward, guns raised, at the slightest suggestion that Miss Hawkins might have been anything less than the perfect picture of pure Southern white womanhood. Willie McGee's first trial lasted less than a day, and the all-white jury took 2.5 minutes to reach a verdict. It was obvious, as Jessica Mitford writes, that ritual race murder was in the offing. McGee lived through three trials. The reversals of his convictions were based on transparently contradictory and perjured testimony and the total exclusion of blacks from the jury pool. He had numerous stays of execution, thanks to a national and international protest campaign organized by the CRC and the tireless efforts by the group's attorneys, several of whom were physically attacked and beaten by Mississippi mobs. After one stay of execution ordered by Supreme Court Justice Harold H. Burton in July 1950, small groups of men were reported to have gathered about the courthouse building in Laurel during the afternoon, expressing resentment at Justice Burton's action and denouncing the damn New York communists and outside interference. The Jackson Daily News, Mississippi's largest newspaper, reflected, and at the time actually encouraged, the race hatred in the white crowds milling around courthouses and squares in many of the state's cities and towns. In May 1951, after Paul Robeson publicly urged McGee's freedom, the newspaper issued a virtually unveiled call for a lynching. Paul Robeson, Negro singer and notorious communist who declares he prefers Russia to the United States, blew off his loud bazoo to the effect that the next step should be to get Willie McGee out of jail. It could happen, but not in the way Robeson is thinking. Despite Judge Burton's stay, the full Supreme Court refused for the third time to review Willie McGee's case. The night before he was electrocuted by the state of Mississippi, he wrote to his wife, Rosalie, quote, "Tell the people the real reason they are going to take my life is to keep the Negro down. They can't do this if you and the children keep on fighting. Never forget to tell them why they killed their daddy. I know you won't fail me. Tell the people to keep on fighting. Your truly husband, Willie McGee." Unquote. Einstein had protested McGee's conviction. Quote, "Any unprejudiced human being must find it difficult to believe that this man really committed rape," unquote, and also attacked the death sentence. Besides Einstein, others signing on to save Willie McGee included Clifford Odets, Diego Rivera, David Siqueiros, Jean Cocteau, Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, Richard Wright, Dmitri Shostakovich, and Sergei Prokofiev. In addition to several blackled and interracial unions in the United States and 11 French newspapers of diverse political views. After McGee's execution, Time and Life magazines directed angry editorial criticism at the communists, not a word about the case itself. But on May 14, 1951, Time added another editorial target. To communists all over the world, the case of Willie McGee had become surefire propaganda, good for whipping up racial tension at home and giving U.S. justice a black eye abroad. Stirred up by the communist leadership, communist liners, and manifesto signers in England, France, China, and Russia, demanded that Willie be freed. But not only communists took up the cry. In New York, Albert Einstein signed a newspaper ad protesting a miscarriage of justice. If he had been white, it's a safe bet McGee never would have been executed. No white man has ever been sentenced to death for rape in the Deep South. Another CRC campaign involved issues of women's rights as well as racial justice. It began on November 4, 1947. Rosa Lee Ingram let out a scream as John Stratford knocked her down with the butt of his rifle. It was a short scream, but long enough for two of her sons, working nearby, to hear. Ingram was a 40-year-old black Georgia tenant farmer and widowed mother of 12 sons. Stratford, a neighboring white tenant farmer, had reportedly been sexually harassing her. But as Stratford moved toward her this time, her sons Wallace and Sammy arrived. One of them wrestled the gun away and struck Stratford on the head. Stratford would not harass anyone else again. Charged with murder, Rosa Lee Ingram and her sons were convicted in a one-day trial with a court-appointed defense attorney by an all-white jury in Ellaville, Georgia. They were sentenced to die in the electric chair. In a hearing on the case in April 1948, their death sentences were commuted to life in prison. But the judge refused to grant a new trial or to consider the question of an all-white jury. The CRC helped to set up three new organizations led by black women, which for the next 6 years waged a campaign of protest activities to free the Ingrams. These CRC-linked radical women's organizations were founded primarily by black women who had some association with the Communist Party, according to historian Robert D.G. Kelly. He adds that perhaps the most important of these groups was the Sojourners for Truth and Justice, founded by Charlotta Bass. Shirley Graham Du Bois, Louise Thompson Patterson, Alice Childress, Bea Richards, and Rosalie McGee, Willie McGee's widow. In a dramatic move, the CRC filed a petition written by W.E.B. Du Bois with the United Nations, arguing that the Ingram convictions violated the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, approved by the U.N. General Assembly. The United Nations refused to consider the case, but the action attracted international media coverage. "My organization is with you 100%, Ida Henderson, co-chair of the Women's Convention Auxiliary of the National Baptist Convention, told the Ingram campaign. Besides approaching churches, the protesters organized 4 public rallies for the Ingrams in Atlanta, collected 100,000 signatures on petitions, and sent 5 multiracial groups of women to Georgia over a period of 5 years to go door-to-door in communities and talk to people about the case. The women in the Ingram campaign also met with journalists, spoke on the radio, lobbied Georgia politicians, and enlisted support from black sororities and a number of the left-led interracial labor unions mentioned earlier. They collected money to send to Rosalie Ingram and her sons in jail. Finally, the Ingrams were freed because of such tireless and selfless efforts. Not all the CRC's or the NAACP's defense efforts were successful, of course. As in the Willie McGee case, worldwide protests in the Martinsville 7 rape case could not stop the state of Virginia from proceeding with their electrocutions. But half a century before there was DNA testing, the Civil Rights Congress was organizing demonstrations to protest unjust and racist court cases, sending delegations to meet with politicians, journalists, and community activists, and telling the story of each case around the world, even as its lawyers challenged the convictions and sentences. The CRC also set up committees of prominent people to speak out publicly on each case. Several of these committees included Einstein. In addition, he publicly endorsed the CRC itself. Einstein would quite likely have endorsed an NAACP-sponsored protest committee as well. But the NAACP, as mentioned earlier, generally did not organize protests when they took a case. While the association did direct lobbying and media outreach, it focused its efforts on trials and appeals. Nevertheless, Einstein expressed admiration for Walter White. The NAACP secretary, who was blonde, blue-eyed, and very fair-skinned, might well have passed for white, but chose to organize and work for civil rights. In October 1947, his article, "Why I Remain a Negro," appeared in the Saturday Review of Literature. It prompted Einstein to send a comment. "On reading the White article, one is struck with the deep meaning of the saying, 'There is only one road to true human greatness, the road through suffering.' If the suffering springs from the blindness and dullness of a tradition-bound society, it usually degrades the weak to a state of blind hate, but exalts the strong to a moral superiority and magnanimity, which would otherwise be almost beyond the reach of man. I believe that every sensitive reader will, as I did myself, put down Walter White's article with a feeling of true thankfulness. He has allowed us to accompany him on the painful road to human greatness by giving us a simple biographical story which is irresistible in its convincing power." White's story may have been irresistible, but when it came to political causes, Einstein joined Robeson, Du Bois, and the CRC. Indeed, almost every civil rights group Einstein endorsed after 1946, including the Council on African-American Affairs, cited earlier, had Robeson in the leadership. Perhaps because he had seen the Nazis use the communist scare tactic, he did not shrink from Robeson's red glare. Like Robeson, the CRC had close ties to the Communist Party. While defending Rosalie Ingram, Willie McGee, the Martinsville 7, and other African-Americans they saw as victims of racist frame-ups, the CRC also supported more than 100 CP officials jailed under the Smith Act during the McCarthy-Hoover period. CRC statements pointed to Hitler's Germany, where the Nazis had first rounded up the communists while most liberals shrugged from what they thought was a safe distance. It was an example Einstein's memory agreed with. "The fear of communism," he declared at the height of the McCarthy era, "has led to practices which have become incomprehensible to the rest of civilized mankind." His outspokenness on civil rights included a virtually unknown interview with the Cheney Record, the student newspaper of a then-small black college, Cheney State, in Pennsylvania. Quote, "Race prejudice has unfortunately become an American tradition which is uncritically handed down from one generation to the next," unquote, Einstein declared. That he agreed to the interview is hardly surprising, given Einstein's previous visit to Lincoln University and his openness in talking and writing to young people. He continued, "The only remedies to racism are enlightenment and education. It is a slow and painstaking process in which all right-thinking people should take part." Shortly after the Cheney interview, Einstein extended his organizational network by sending a message to the Southwide Conference on Discrimination in Higher Education, held at Atlanta University in 1950 and sponsored by the Southern Conference Education Fund. With the Red Scare, congressional investigating committees like HUAC had red-baited virtually any Southern group that called for integration and driven many of them out of existence. The Highlander Folk School, where Rosa Parks took part in interracial discussions during the summer before her famous arrest for refusing to move to the back of a Montgomery, Alabama bus, was one of the few organizations that managed to survive. Another was the Southern Conference Educational Fund, SCEF. 4 years before Brown v. Board of Education, SCEF sponsored a rare integrated conference in the South, albeit at a black university, to oppose racism in Southern universities. In his greeting to the group, Einstein wrote, "If an individual commits an injustice, he is harassed by his conscience. But nobody is apt to feel responsible for misdeeds of a community, in particular, if they are supported by old traditions. Such is the case with discrimination. Every right-minded person will be grateful to you for having united to fight this evil that so grievously injures the dignity and the repute of our country. Only by spreading education among all our people can we approach the ideals of democracy. Your fight is not easy, but in the end, you will succeed." Perhaps Einstein's most effective civil rights action was testimony he actually didn't give. At the start of 1951, the federal government indicted W.E.B. Du Bois, then chairman of the Peace Information Center, and four of the group's other officers for failing to register as foreign agents. The government's principal charge was that the Peace Information Center, described by Kelly as an anti-nuclear, anti-Cold War group, had committed the overt act of circulating the Stockholm Peace Petition. If one needs a single image to represent McCarthyism in America, it might well be the picture of W.E.B. Du Bois in 1951 facing a judge in a federal courtroom. The world-renowned black scholar, at the age of 83, goateed, short in height but standing unbent, wearing a pinstriped three-piece suit and handcuffs. Like Robeson, Du Bois had refused to go along with Washington's anti-Soviet, anti-communist policies, refused to cooperate with the congressional investigating committees, had his passport suspended, and had been ousted from the NAACP. Shortly after the federal indictment, Einstein sent Du Bois a copy of his just-published book, Out of My Later Years. It was almost exactly 20 years after Einstein had first heard from Du Bois and written his statement for the crisis. In April, Du Bois wrote back and included information about his upcoming court case. Quote, "Mrs. Du Bois and I have received your autographed book with deep appreciation and will read it with pleasure and profit. I am venturing to enclose with this letter a statement on a case in which you may be interested," unquote. Einstein quickly volunteered to testify as a defense witness in Du Bois' federal trial. To give Einstein's appearance in court the maximum impact, defense attorney Vito Marcantonio held back the announcement until the last minute. In a rare first-hand account, Shirley Graham Du Bois describes the judge's response. "The prosecution rested its case during the morning of November 20th. Marcantonio told the judge that only one defense witness was to be presented, Dr. Du Bois. But," Marcantonio added casually to the judge, "Dr. Albert Einstein has offered to appear as a character witness for Dr. Du Bois." Judge Matthew F. McGuire fixed Marcantonio with a long look, and then adjourned the court for lunch. When court resumed, Judge McGuire granted the motion for acquittal. Confronted with the prospect of international publicity that would have resulted from Einstein's testimony, the judge dismissed the case for lack of evidence before the defense had a chance to present its witnesses. 9 days later, Dr. Du Bois wrote Einstein again. "My dear Dr. Einstein, I write to express my deep appreciation of your generous offer to do anything that you could in the case brought against me by the Department of Justice. I am delighted that in the end it was not necessary to call upon you and interfere with your great work and needed leisure, but my thanks for your generous attitude is not less on that account. Mrs. Du Bois joins me in deep appreciation. Very sincerely yours, W.E.B. Du Bois."
As I said, no messing up the audio this week. Context of white supremacy. We'll be back next week. It looks like we could finish this next week. We should be done. It's not a whole lot left. We'll have to see. Hoping we can read White Dog next. Whew, so excited. We'll have to talk about that another day. The number 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you did not get to share at all, go ahead and get a hand up now. Do not wait until the last minute. If you haven't spoken at all, if you think you have something you want to share, history.com, they have a 2018 article, Thurgood Marshall had a secret relationship, whatever that means, with the FBI, and they go on to talk about more detail. I'll post it there, just talking about whether or not the NAACP had a relationship with the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover. Whew, lots to say about this week's section. We'll get right to the phone lines, folks who dialed in. Strom Thurmond, that was a big cowbell, former senator who has a statue up right now, and in fact, they are having discussions right now, the past few days, about whether or not he has statues and buildings named after him as well. On the campus of the University of South Carolina, he has, I think it's several buildings named after him, a fitness center and a residential facility. The great Strom Thurmond, cowbell, rapist Strom Thurmond. Child, excuse me, be accurate, strive for accuracy. Child rapist Strom Thurmond. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, non-Clemson grad, and Miss C, retired firefighter, Thomaston, New York, others, Silent Warrior should be with us. I'll look for folks if you've not shared at all. Proceed.
Can I go first?
Feel free, sir.
Can I be heard?
We'll get.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. We'll get Silent Warrior since okay. It's so late for him, and then we'll get Miss C as well.
Okay. So I see just a few quotes here, where you say that, like you've also said, where Einstein says the problem is white. Getting some feedback. Where Einstein says the problem, racism is a problem of white people. I think that's very valuable because it can be maybe used to make it more difficult for other whites to gaslight black people and still know racism doesn't exist. It's kind of hard when Einstein is saying it. Fun fact, this term Mink Slide, it is also the name of Tariq Nasheed's music group that make funky 70s, 80s F&B, R&B music, Mink Slide. So I wonder if Tariq chose this term Mink Slide based on this history of what happened in Tennessee. Very interesting point that he made about not wanting the blood of Negroes and connecting it to not even wanting to grab a hold of a rope that would save your life from drowning. And my impression from this, the biggest impact I got from this book so far is I want to go read that biography of Robeson, because it makes Muhammad Ali seem not so militant. I mean, Robeson didn't even seem to need organization to train him to think critically. I'm impressed. And just to round it off, I think Einstein was, you know, the authors talk about how Einstein has this Dr. Feelgood perspective placed on him, and people think, oh, he's just a bumbling grandfather and so on. But just think about it. He's a Jew, white, an old man. He's a Jew, so isn't this, and very smart. And isn't that a stereotype of what God should be like? Old, white, and Jewish? Isn't that the symbolism that's probably working on people's heads? I think they were already really pushing this. And you see this from the description of him as a biblical character on page 89. There's something I felt about, there's a lot of instances in this book where the authors are speculating on how the relationship might have been between Einstein and Robeson. We might have well heard them talk about conversation. Like, for example, that Einstein might have heard about lynching from his conversations with the people, black people in Princeton. And yet, they have a whole chapter of people talking about how nice it is to see him and he's so good to be around. But none of those people ever talk about, they actually spoke about racism with him. Why couldn't these authors investigate instead of speculate? That's all I got for now. Thank you.
Much obliged, Silent Warrior. Miss C, down in South Carolina. Oh, make sure I'm trying to preserve the audio. All right, there we go. Miss C should be with us.
Yes. So to begin, I would like to say Anita McCormick Blaine. It said that she was an heiress to, the heiress to the International Harvester fortune. She wrote a check for Henry A. Wallace's campaign, and it was a $10,000 check, and in today's amount, it would be $119,000. I thought that was a significant amount of money to contribute to a third party, the Progressive Party. I noted a lot, I hope other people will talk more on this, but the FBI screening for communists or potential people who are informants or spies for the Russians, they were stirring up hysteria, fear, and terror among the people. And they said a frightened population is an easy to control population. And I just related that to what's going on right now. People are talking about race wars. People are talking about, you know, what do we do in relation to COVID-19? You know, do we stay inside? Do we go outside? Do we wear the mask? Do we not wear the mask? There's a lot of fear and hysteria surrounding the uprisings and retaliation. It is July 4th weekend, and there could potentially be revolutionaries out there trying to reassert their hegemony against Black people this weekend. Another thing I noted was the Detroit NAACP membership decreased by 80%. It went from 25,000 to 5,000 people in terms of their membership. And that just goes to show you, like, the government can cause your entire organization to crumble from the inside out just by stirring up fear and hysteria, especially with the Red Scare. Like, people probably got attacked, people probably got killed. They were socially ostracized. Their neighbors were spying in on them, acting as informants for the government and sending in your information. And maybe you had nothing to do with communism or leftist ideology, but maybe they just didn't like you. And so they would share that information with the government, and it would destroy your entire life. And I feel like that's what's going on right now. You see a lot of people, they'll accuse Black people or so-called progressives or social justice warriors. They'll accuse them of being communist and anti-America and going around calling all white people racist and saying, like, you're destroying my life. Why are you destroying my life by calling me a racist? And from the last audio clip, I just wanted to mention, this has nothing really to do with the book, but in reading about all this history and about this time period in the 1940s, I was researching some mathematicians, and I came across two very important ones that I can relate to what we're reading in this book, Einstein on Race and Racism. The first one is Jesse Ernest Wilkins, Jr. They call him the Negro genius. He graduated with like a PhD at 19. And at the age of 22, he was invited to work on the Manhattan Project. They didn't want to bring him in because he was a Negro and he was colored, but because he was a genius and he knew so much, they didn't tell him what the research was about. They didn't tell him what the ultimate goal was in creating the atomic bomb until after it was dropped on Hiroshima. But they used this Black man, they used his knowledge and his talent in nuclear engineering and applied mathematics and mechanical engineering to create this bomb alongside geniuses like Einstein, and then they did destruction in this world, murdered 200,000 people in Hiroshima, Japan, to profit off of it. That was another thing, like destruction, World War II, World War I, created so much profit for the United States. And while other people were starving, the United States was living in abundance. The other mathematician I studied was David Blackwell, and he was a statistician. He did game theory and probability, and he also was a genius, and he graduated at a young age with his doctorate at around 22, and he applied for a fellowship at Princeton University, and he was among like five people. He was denied the teaching position, but they gave him the 1-year fellowship, and they said, you're going to get the fellowship because they would never allow you to be a teacher. And then the guy, he said, well, how do you know? And he was like, well, you're black, you're a Negro. And they would never have a Black professor standing in front of all their students and teaching their students. So he ended up with the fellowship, and he got denied a professorship at a college or university also in California. I think it was Berkeley. So just two interesting people that I studied and how it relates to what was going on, you know, with segregation and racism within this book. With that, I will meet my line.
Much obliged, Miss C in South Carolina, non-Clemson grad. Other folks, if you have comments, observations, questions, why Dr. Welsing thought we should read this here book, proceed. We got our narrator, Mel, who has done phenomenal work. All of the pronunciations and foreign names, excellent job.
Thank you. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I have three major points, a question, and then several smaller points. I'm not going to do the smaller points. First point, in the Detroit labor section, most of my points are for the first section of the reading. In the Detroit labor section, there is an author named Bill Fletcher. He's a black male who talks about labor movements and how union efforts have been constantly undercut by the racism of the white people in the same unions, and how this same racism stops union efforts up until today, like till today. On page 98, there's a quote, "It seems so naturally America's movement that no problem was too big for our brain power and energy. The telescope was built in California, first penicillin invented, civilian penicillin." And in my mind, I'm just thinking racism is stopping all kinds of inventions. Like, we'd be zapping across galaxies, teleporting right now if it weren't for racism. And that it causes what this like delay in technology to me, that it's just a waste of human energy. I heard a statistic from astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, actually, on his podcast Star Talk, about how in World War II, there was one B-52 bomber created every single hour. And that's just a large amount of energy invested in the murder of other human beings. But it's so hard to protect black people just trying to move into some houses next to the plant that they can build the B-52s. Likewise, black people only seem semi-protected when working in the interests of the government, as we know from that man who was arrested last week for planning that white supremacist attack on the essential worker black soldiers and his group overseas, which brings me to the inaccuracy. So on page 95, if the majority knew the root of this evil, then the road to its cure would not be long. I interpreted Einstein's statement in two ways. One, on its face, it's not true. Social media and news media will show you that statistics and evidence mean nothing. George Floyd is still happening. And then two, if he's possibly referencing the root cause of racism, and if we want to assume that that realization is supposed to be about the threat of color confrontation, Einstein is referencing a root that he's not defining outside of hate. So he's saying, oh, if only, white people knew about this root of the racism, or about if people knew about the root of their evil, then they wouldn't be doing it. It just makes no sense. Also, in that same section, when Hoover quashes the investigation into the Four Little Girls church bombing, to me, that emphasizes that we have a perfectly good, not perfectly, but we have a good system of laws and terms already in existence. But as Neely Fuller says, law is what you do. And until we get actual law enforcement and not race soldiers, the problem will remain. That's just with a note to the current protests. And then my final point was on the value of Einstein's efforts so far. So there's this a section that says, quote, in 1943, I can't quote it. In 1943, it signaled his determination to use his name publicly. And I'm just thinking aloud, okay, he's been here. Einstein has been here since 1929, when that sidewalk was still not in Witherspoon. This particular signal to use his name publicly should have happened in the previous 14 years, before 1943. And they said that the author said, quote, future statements would not be so moderate. And I'm just confused, because later on it said, quote, not limited to articles and speeches, Robeson asked Einstein to join the American Council to End Lynching as a co-chair. So I'm like, okay, so the future statements are not moderate. Robeson asked you to join this chair. And then continuing on page 95, his sharpest attack is an Urban League message. Loosely, a slap in the face of the a slap in the face of the Constitution to the nation. That's what racism is. And the people who wrote the Constitution are racist. So how is it a slap in the face to the Constitution? Concentration camps and eugenicist practices in America are what inspired Nazi activities. There's a book called Hitler's American Model. So my conclusion basically is that Einstein is not serious about solving the problem of racism. And I thought that from the very first chapter. I said, I think Witherspoon is, like, his walks into Witherspoon are like a journey into Westworld for him. Like, racism is just a strain on his blue sky. Like, he had to understand that lynchings and white people raping black people are not, like, usually economic-based crimes. They're psychopathic crimes. This inexcusable tunnel vision, in my opinion, is bordering on dishonesty. Like, if Tim Wise starts walking through Witherspoon Street in 2020, nobody better write a book about him, because he also wrote a whole lot. He might be on some councils. I don't know. Also, in various sections of the book, Einstein's response keeps getting called mild by the authors when referenced alongside Hoover's, psychotic dossiers. And I just think that's a point to note also. And then my question that I wanted to end on, is Princeton going to sell that Woodrow Wilson statue to pay for a black person's tuition? Can they have the police come and take the statue down and put the statue in handcuffs? Because I would enjoy that spectacle. I'm just remembering that time they took that statue down in Charlottesville, and it was a parade for the white people standing alongside the road. They put their hands on their hearts, and they were crying as this racist statue was getting carted on this pickup truck or whatever down the street. It was just a mess. And then I had random notes, but I'll stop there. Thank you.
Random notes. That's hilarious. Our narrator, Mel, fantastic work. I don't know if they have a statue. Do they have a, I know he has multiple buildings on the campus of Princeton. I don't know if he got a statue too. I'm sure he has one, you know, elsewhere. He was a United States president, but on the Princeton campus, I know he's got buildings, multiple. So yeah, it's lots they could do to give that money to some black people. I'm sure they could find Polite Paul and Jigger and see if they have offspring in the area. Some of the other black people on Witherspoon Street that he would sit out on the front stoop and, you know, hook them up. You got free scholarship. If you know you need to take 8 years to finish, take 8 years. Don't worry about it. Other folks that we missed totally, if you have observations, comments, questions, why Dr. Welsing thought we should read this book.
Can I be heard again?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I'm not sure on why Dr. Welsing wanted us to read the book. But I have some reports. Primarily, it still is on the first part of the reading of the book tonight. Something that was going on right around the great Albert Einstein that he could have addressed. Fellow scientist and doctor, happened to be a black male. This is one of the first things that we were taught in elementary school in the 60s about Dr. Charles Drew. He was the scientist behind what we know today as blood plasma, and he actually died and couldn't even gain the advantage of his invention. Because he needed blood plasma and wasn't rendered access to it. Also during that time, speaking about German prisoners of war, they were moved into the quote-unquote southern states in this part of the world, the ones that were captured by the United States military. And in turn, a white Nazi or German POW could walk around in the different places in the South, patronize businesses as long as he had on a shirt that had POW on it, whereas we know that non-white black people did not have that means to practice at all. I have here also as an addition to Thomas' comment about the amount of cost of quote unquote segregation, this is why the first large corporation within this part of the world to rescind quote unquote segregation was the United States military in 1948 under Harry Truman. Because it was costing the military millions of dollars, which would probably turn into day billions of dollars or more, and they no way in the world they could have retained black males who were in the Air Force. Well, at that time it was Army Air Corps, it wasn't the Air Force until 1948, because those bases were. Everything that had to do with those bases were black people, including the doctors, the mechanics, the people who cleaned the yards, you know, and nowhere in the world they could keep up with that kind of money to have a black base and a white, quote-unquote, base. The reason why the quote-unquote Soviet Union was so comfortable with when they were informed about the atomic bomb during the Potsdam Conference was because the secret, if you will, was already rendered to the Soviet Union at the time when Stalin was informed of it. So I say that to say that white people always, even at the time where they were may have some disagreements with one another, they still had an alliance with each other. And as long as quote unquote the Soviet Union or Russia has had this adversarial relationship with white people in this part of the world, they have never came to a large spirit of bloody disagreement with each other. That is white supremacy in itself, an example of it anyway. Last but not least, I'm also wondering about the relationship that Albert Einstein had with, he has a long name. I'll just finish with the, he's the person that was the author behind what we know today as NASA. He's also was a Nazi, and he was also a physicist at the same time. His name was Von Braun. I'm pretty sure the relationship was not, negative. So that's also some, suspicion about his sincerity, as a quote unquote white ally. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Did we miss anybody?
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Can I be heard? Yes, sir. Great narration, by the way, for the female caller. J. Edgar Hoover book. I saw one, Gus. It's called FBI's, like EYES Eyes, How J. Edgar Hoover's Ghostwriters Framed African American Literature. And says here, drawing on nearly 14,000 pages of newly released FBI files, FBI's exposes the Bureau's intimate policy of five decades of African-American poems, plays, essays, and novels, so probably threatening writers, things of that nature. Just thought that was interesting. I think Albert Einstein was a very refined racist. He was a Jew in Nazi Germany, you know. He now lives in the United States. I know he had to draw the correlation. He probably lived in the United States longer than he lived in Germany. I'm not sure about that. But he died really recently. You know, it would have been honest and right of him to be very serious with talking to his so-called black friends about racism and white supremacy, as opposed to writing things appealing to the white moral consciousness. So, you know, I would think someone from Nazi Germany would have the notion that, you know, white people who don't have a moral consciousness, especially what his people had experienced there, according to them. The United Nations, black people are still talking about going to the United Nations. I mean, this was way back when. Still a waste of time. You know, it's in New York. It's funded almost solely by the United States. And the only thing more powerful than a United States vote is a United States non-vote. So it's a waste of time. And it's still being pushed around in the black, talking points. It doesn't make sense. Albert Einstein, they seem to listen to his advice on Russia. You know, give them a nuclear weapon too, balance the powers. I mean, his expertise and things seem to be taken on very, very seriously by the United States there. However, not on the racist, you know, not on racism and white supremacy. You know, just go over there, we're going to watch you. But when it came down to talking about white-on-white affairs, right after that, didn't Russia get nuclear weapons? It seems like they became the two superpower and balance of power in the world between two white people. Just perfect, you know. And it seems like one thing, anytime you see a politician that says they're progressive, that's socialist, you know, now they actually come out and say, we're just democratic socialists. You know, they're all progressives now. But that whole movement, how dangerous McCarthyism was, just to label someone a Russian sympathizer, you know, and the amount of surveillance that entails. And, they did it to all the black, anyone who was against them, that was all they had to do. It was just genius on behalf of Dad, or whoever it is, but Mr. McCarthy. I'm in my line. Thank you.
Much obliged. Thomas in New York. Did we miss any callers? Nice.
I dropped in 1 minute.
Hang on 1 second, because I haven't shared any thoughts. And we had a reader who wrote in. I can hear you, Silent Warrior. Just give me 1 second. I know it's still late. One of our listeners wrote in. He said, number one, regarding... So, he said regarding Einstein, but just I had on my mind because they've been talking about Epstein and his partner was arrested today. All of that underage sex. Regarding Einstein and sex, I noted his second wife, Elsa, was knowingly his first cousin on the maternal side and the second cousin on the paternal side. At the very least, this seems odd and at worst a sign of sexual deviancy. Oh no, we got that again. Number two, I noticed the use of the term minorities to describe victims by Albert Einstein in a letter to W.E.B. Du Bois regarding racism in 1931. I always thought the use of the term began in the 1960s and 70s. Clearly, the term has been in common usage for much longer. Important observation. Number three, I'm enjoying the text, especially the section on Princeton, New Jersey. Much different take on the town from what I have always thought. Pristine little Ivy League enclave versus plantation of terror for black people. The section describing ringing a bell so the children can run for their lives reads like a scene from a horror film or Warmth of Other Suns or a number of the other books that we've read where white people terrorize black people. Number three, the text has a quote from a racist Detroit assembly worker. Oh, I read that one. I'd rather see Hitler, blah, blah, blah. I thought this statement exemplifies the thinking of white supremacists. There is nothing more important than maintaining the global system of white supremacy racism. Absolutely. Number four, interesting metaphors in the reading regarding the racist senator Robert Byrd. Byrd has since undergone a sea change in his views on race. Regarding the crusade against lynching and the subsequent civil rights movement. One more ripple in the current that would swell into a giant wave of people. What in the world? That's why we have no metaphors on the compensatory call. Number four, I'm so glad he wrote this one down because I had this written down. I wrote this down in between like, oh man, I didn't get to read that note. I took that one like, dang, I got to get that in. And we got it right here. But I had this down, just forgot. I'm glad listeners were paying attention. Number four, the Moores Ford Bridge lynching was mentioned in the text, which was discussed on the cows in a program regarding the book by Laura Wexler, The Moores Ford Bridge Lynching. That's the one, 1940s, they dragged, it was two black males, a pregnant black female, another black female, dragged them out, shot them. That's the case they were talking about in the first audio segment, Moores Ford Bridge Lynching down in Georgia. Still don't have anyone who was charged for that. And we talked about that with Keith Beauchamp as well. And he said, white people bragged. They knew that's not a secret. They knew who did it. And they're just protecting a murderer or murderers, excuse me. Number five, the dichotomy between the relatively gentle treatment of the immigrant Einstein by U.S. authorities for his supposed activism and the lifelong terrorizing of Du Bois and Robeson is a major theme for me in this text. I suspect the authors were likely more interested in promoting a theme celebrating Einstein's activism. Please include me when, if you distribute the White Dog PDF. Ooh. I was also taken aback by the price of the book on Amazon. Right? It's like $300 for some of those books on for used copy as well. Great comment as well about the comparison. How Einstein, like, he's on the COINTELPRO list as well, but he can go around and do all this, and they don't compromise his livelihood. He can still take his strolls. They took Robeson's passport. The accusations or allegations that he was drugged. We talked about that. FBI's war against Tupac Shakur and black leaders. We talked about that repeatedly. John Patash. Very different treatment for those individuals. Let's see. A few notes. Let's see how fast that Morris Ford got that. They talked about having a one-world government to kind of be responsible for nuclear weapons. The system of white supremacy is a one-world government. We already had that. That's what white people do. They work together, sometimes overtly and sometimes covertly, to manage the affairs of the world. That's what the system is. Let's see. They talked about how there was a correspondence between Einstein, Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, and that the only reason that they were able to maintain this correspondence was because it was filed away in the FBI's COINTELPRO files. I just think that that's, you know, significant in terms of how much time and energy they can devote to pretty much anything. If it's studying other Negroes or projects, science projects, NASA, whatever it is, that's what you can do when you dominate. Let's see. Thought it was important, they said, since World War II had been such a financial bonanza for American capitalism, Charles E. Wilson, president of General Motors, known for speaking bluntly, proposed an ongoing partnership between business and the military for a permanent war economy with Moscow as the chief enemy. Now, you can look at this, and people have written about this and some of the roots of what is happening now with policing and how they end up having tanks and all this amazing military gear when you have a surplus, when you have a permanent military economy. That ends, you end up having what they call mission creep. Maybe you don't have Moscow as an enemy. Maybe we'll just find the local black people or whatever it is. But that is directly tied to some of what's happening right now. Let's see. God himself had divined that America be the one nation to carry the responsibility for the atomic bomb. This was said by a British prime minister, the religion of white supremacy. And that British prime minister, that's your one world government. Let's see. I just thought it was an important contrast. They said they had thousands of people, and we talked about this with Dr. Charles Hyde. Thousands of whites went out and protested, marched, rioted about black people just in Michigan. It says thousands of letters and telegrams from Americans, well-known and unknown, were worried about the trend toward militarism and angry about federal inaction against lynching. It didn't say tens of thousands. It didn't say hundreds of thousands. That quote that was mentioned before, white people are often sincerely and greatly pained. It sounds like they weren't even sincerely and greatly pained about the lynching. Like they didn't. I mean, this is at a time when people wrote letters like they tweeted. You didn't even have very many people to write a letter. Like, could we please stop lynching the Negro? Yeah. Let's see. They mentioned the Dixiecrats, Strom Thurmond, rapist. I said they're talking about taking his statues down right now. He led a lot of the racist charge, didn't want little black children to get educated, and he was raping a black child in a similar situation that they talk about later in the book, so-called domestic help. And he ends up raping her and producing a child. His offspring, in fact, has a book. I just don't have the name of it, but I thought we should read it for the book club. But his the product, offspring of his rapes, has written a book about the experience. But he still got statues down. South Carolina, non-Clemson grad in Miss C. Don't think they've taken them down yet. The name calling is so effective. They say you're red, or at least a pinko, or a commie simp. And communist sympathizer. They do all this name calling, and most of the name calling is non-white names. Red, pinko, not white. That's how we know you're in trouble. Let's see. They had a footnote, just wanted to include Einstein's warning could not have been closer to the mark about
the danger of all this McCarthyism and Red Scare and everything. 1 month later, on March 19, Paul Robeson became the first American to be banned from television when NBC barred his appearance on the very same program, Today with Mrs. Roosevelt. NBC Executive Vice President Charles Denny declared no good purpose would be served by having him speak on the issue of Negro politics. And they say Negro. let's see. Oh, yeah, I already read. There's no evidence that anything like the ACLU's bedding down with Hoover's bureau occurred in the NAACP. That is patently false. And, in fact, we read some of this in Dr. Gerald Horn's biography on Paul Robeson, where he talked about how the NAACP turned on Paul Robeson so viciously, Walter White included. And that was a part of it, in addition to the report that I already mentioned from History.com talking about Thurgood Marshall's relationship. He was with the NAACP's legal defense team. So I think there's quite a bit of evidence that the FBI had thoroughly infiltrated the NAACP and pretty much all of the organizations founded by black people to work against white supremacy racism. That's why you end up having people like Robert F. Williams, who end up having lots of problems later on. North Carolina. Let's see. They used the term, talking about this, they say, oh, it wasn't part of the leadership's plan. The purges weakened the organization. The NAACP became more moderate, more middle class. I don't know what that means. Became more middle class. What does that mean? No poor people, ostensibly, but what does that mean? How much money exactly? Are you no longer poor? Let's see. It's actually recommended in Mr. Fuller's word guide. He says not to use the term middle class for that reason exactly. Black people, no matter how much money you have, experience white supremacy racism. They say my husband raped Wilhelmina Hawkins. Rosalie McGee told the Harlem newspaper Freedom. But I say if anybody was raped, which there wasn't, it was Wilhelmina Hawkins raped Willie, the black male, not the other way around. In a scenario recalling the false rape accusation that is at the center of To Kill a Mockingbird, Wilhelmina Hawkins wouldn't leave Willie alone. She followed him around on the job where he worked, a white woman in the South. If she wants a Negro man for herself, she don't care if he has a wife and children or not. If he does what she wants, she can holler rape. If he doesn't, she can still holler rape. If somebody else doesn't like what's going on, they can holler rape. No way can the Negro man win. The man, not and Michael Jackson. Insert, remember? You can't win. Used to play that on the cows on a pretty regular basis. Might have to see if we can slide it in again. But the man, not Dr. Curry. They had that term in here. So I already mentioned Walter White, who they mentioned in the book. Oh, this is not the right. They use fair-minded a few times in the text, which is also in the word guide not to use. Let's see. They also refer to this as a ritual race murder. That reminded me of Delectable Negro, consumption of black bodies. It also reminded me of the religion of white supremacy. They refer to Paul Robeson when he's talking about white supremacy racism. It's quoted in the book. Paul Robeson, Negro singer and notorious communist who declares he prefers Russia to United States, blew off his loud bazoo to the effect that the next step should be to get Willie McGee out of jail. And this is a quote from a newspaper at the time. Bazoo, B-A-Z-O-O. I looked up the definition for the term bazoo. It does. There is a definition. It's kind of an older term, not as in use as much, meaning a person's mouth. But the second definition is a person's buttocks or anus. I just thought that was interesting because I had not heard that term bazoo used before to describe someone's mouth. And I thought it was interesting where you have, you could just say mouth, blew off his loud mouth. But to use this kind of interesting informal word that also means buttocks or anus. Thought that was significant. Let's see. No white man has ever been sentenced to death for rape in the Deep South. We talked about that before. Let's see. Stratford, a neighboring white tenant farmer, had reportedly been sexually harassing her. Oh, this is a different case, Rosalie Ingram. But as Stratford moved toward her this time, her sons Wallace and Sammy arrived. One of them wrestled the gun away and struck Stratford on the head. Stratford would not harass anyone else again. Like I said, there's so many examples of black people fighting back. It's so ridiculous when people say black people are cowards and the problem is we don't fight back. There's lots of cases like these folks here.
black self-respect. And again, just like Strom Thurmond, the white rapist. Let's see. The weak United Nations, Thomas in New York already got that. Let's see. Oh, my goodness. We got an important footnote here. And Dr. Gerald Horn, this is the week that we get him on the cows. Like, whoo, our timing has just been out of control. So the bottom of 116, special note, in Mississippi and Virginia, all 50 people executed for rape in the first half of the 20th century were black. Coon man. Dr. Gerald Horn, Communist Front, page 75. Since 1992, attorneys for the Innocence Project, a nonprofit group based in New York, have used DNA fingerprinting to reverse the convictions of 153 men as of November 2004, including many on death row who were awaiting executions for crimes, usually rape or murder, they did not commit. The attorneys argue that even where there is no DNA evidence available, the pattern of their successful cases shows a system slanted against defendants of color and those without money. Now, they describe Walter White. Nevertheless, Einstein expressed admiration for Walter White, the NAACP secretary, who was blonde, blue-eyed, and very fair-skinned. Might well have passed for white, and it goes on. Walter White has been mentioned in like a billion of our book club sessions. Like, it would hurt my head to like go back and track all the different times that we've talked about him. He was mentioned in that Paul Robeson book. I just told you, though, he ended up being one of the people who attacked and vilified Paul Robeson. That's why I said it's not true about evidence of the FBI using them in that capacity. I don't believe there was evidence of the FBI directly like ordering Walter White to attack Paul Robeson. But I mean, wow, it's a whole lot of that information there in terms of how the NAACP as a body, Walter White specifically, treated Paul Robeson and helped kind of neutralize him. Let's see. Yeah, I think folks touched on it beautifully. The whole myth or notion that white people are ignorant about racism and that education is what's going to solve this problem is like total nonsense. And we've heard a lot of this same type of phooey. More recently, some of the white anti-racist, I mean, yeah, nothing about this would be, yeah, that Einstein is no, not at all. It's the same, just buckets of words and not doing a whole lot. And then the appropriate suspicion, he might be doing some sexual molestation or some sexual deviancy here, too. And they had one more note, footnote 22, Dr. Gerald Horn, black and red, page 209. Ben Bell of the Chicago branch, in NAACP branch, informed Roy Wilkins that he had checked with the FBI. So that would be even some evidence, right? That would, see, in my view, now, if the authors, if you got a footnote in your own book that seems to be suggesting that there is some connection between the FBI and them kind of coercing what's happening with the NAACP and their field branches, then, and Roy Wilkins was later head of the NAACP, why would you say that it doesn't seem like there's any evidence? Just go ahead and make it plain. The FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, they had wide reach. All kinds of organs, even more so-called radical, like the Black Panther Party. If they were influencing what was happening there and had agent provocateurs, why would I think the NAACP would be immune? More, I think, in my view, major deceptiveness on the part of the authors. We'll get Silent Warrior. That'll be our bit. We did a little bit of overtime today, but, you know, be inspired by reading. Silent Warrior.
Thank you, Gus. I now have 7 new book tags. Want to read them, recommend this, and I will never stop reading. Why is a big business and for white supremacy, its fun and its profit, they dropped the bomb. They start to develop the military industrial complex.
This should be like 60 seconds, too. This isn't big commentary. This is like 60 seconds.
England, so they want to keep a big enemy, so they decide to use Russia for that. But my thing I wanted to end on was that when Einstein is talking to the integrated conference to oppose racism in Southern universities, he talks about only by spreading education among all our people can we approach the ideals of democracy. Your fight is not easy, but in the end, you will succeed. I felt, why didn't you say this to Germany? Why didn't you say this about Germany to the president? Instead, you tell the president of the United States, build the bomb.
So he proposes aggression to fight that, but for when it comes to racism, where people are dying, he says education. I think that's enough for me.
Much obliged, Silent Warrior. Hanging in super late, or I guess it's morning now. The sun is probably coming up, 5:18 a.m. Norway time. Yikes. Last thing, reading, so important, never stop reading. It was talked about Belgium and how many folks King Leopold slaughtered. I've read the book, although I don't think we've done it in the book club, although we talked about it with a scholar from American University. He wrote Pipe Dream Blues. He's a black Clarence Lussain. That's it. Clarence Lussain, black male. He was on the program in 2010 where we did talk about this. King Leopold's Ghost, a story of greed, terror, and heroism in colonial Africa. Now, this is written by a white man, suspected racist, Adam Hochschild. I read this book because Josh Wickett did a counter-racist book review of this book, so that's how I found out about it, and then I read it. It does have a lot of great information about terrorism in Belgium, but all of that said, we did talk about it with Clarence Lussain, some of the how racism creeps up in this too, but that was mentioned before. Global system. With that, we'll be here tomorrow for Neutralizing Workplace Racism. We'll be here next week as we try to wrap up the book. I'll send out the link for folks if you want to try to get a PDF. If we have any university students, you might be able to access a PDF of White Dog right now. I'll see if I can post the link. Sobriety would be best under conditions of racism, white supremacy. In addition to being so fireworks going off as I speak, man, battle simulation. In addition, or if you need a reminder about why we want to be sober, and I think Miss C mentioned July 4th and race soldiers might have some ideas about what they need to rekindle this weekend. I said be sober before I was interrupted. In addition to be sober, I would be in the house. I've seen recommendations. They say the Rona is still running rampant. If you're going to celebrate fireworks and all that, do it in the house. Racist man, racist woman, racist child, they are armed. That's a good reason to be in the house. And particularly if you're going to have intoxicated race soldiers in the States this week because it's a big holiday. Oh, yeah. Major reason. Be in the house. If you got to go out, you are alert, paying attention to what's happening around you. Anything looks unsafe, you are out of there. Half of the audio segments for the compensatory call-in will be reports of armed white people accosting black people. That has never been the case in the history of the compensatory call-in, but it will be this week. Half of the audio segments will be reports about white people accosting black people with guns generally. Anywho, sober, buckled, if you're driving, you're not on the cell phone because you got to be watching out for armed white people. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. Be vigilant. There are many armed race soldiers with no badge all across the U.S. Be very, very alert. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. A victim.
Yeah. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.